You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Stuart Butler. I'm a senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution. And I want to welcome you to the discussion today into Brookings. To the discussion today about how communities and community institutions can boost neighborhood health. And I want to welcome everybody who's online watching this program today. Now, it's accepted, I think, generally that the United States is among the best medical facilities available for anybody. But we're also recognizing that it takes a village to promote health in our communities. Local institutions and non-medical services, like housing, schools, social services, are crucially important in ensuring that that communities are healthy. But unfortunately, in America today, we spend an enormous amount of money fixing people and not enough on dealing with those issues and with those resources that are available in communities to help people be healthy. It's time, I think, for us to spend a little less time on fixing people and a little more money and time on reducing the need to fix them. For example, if you look at the amount of money the United States spends on medical care, as you probably know, we spend over 17% of our GDP on health services in this country, well above other countries in the world. But if you take together the amount we spend on health and medical services and social services and combine them, we're pretty much just a little bit above the median level in the world. So in the combination, we're pretty much in the middle. The issue is that of that proportion, of that total amount, the proportion that we spend on medical services as opposed to other services, many of which improve health, is actually extremely high compared with other countries. The average for the industrialized countries in this in the world is roughly of the combination of medical services and other social services. The average is for countries to spend about 37% of that combination on healthcare services. In the United States, it's 64%. We are a complete outlier. We spend far more fixing people with medical care and far less than other countries by comparison in dealing with these social factors in healthcare. So this morning, we're going to explore this issue a little bit more with three panels. The first panel, which I will be joining too, the first panel will be looking at the role of social factors in improving healthcare in our neighborhoods and communities. In the second panel, we'll hear from some individuals who are tackling these same factors sort of in the front line and are involved in linking together social services and medical services to improve healthcare generally. And then to wrap up, we'll have a panel that will look at some of the implications of all of this for public policy and for the conduct of the way in which we run our health system in this country. Before we begin, I would just ask you to silence your cell phone so that it doesn't interfere with the broadcast of this event. I'd also like to thank the Aetna Foundation, which has contributed to support this event, and we're very grateful for that. And Dr. Garth Graham, who's president of the Aetna Foundation, will be joining us on the third panel. As always, I'd like to reiterate Brookings' commitment to independence and to underscore that all panelists will be giving their own personal views. The opening panel, as I said, I'll just be joining in a moment, will be moderated by my colleague, Dr. Kavita Patel. Kavita has many years immersed in both public policy and actually in the practice of medicine. She is a practicing primary care internist at Johns Hopkins Medicine at D.C. Sibley Hospital here in Washington. She's a non-resident fellow at Brookings and was previously the manager of clinical transformation at the Brookings Center for Health Policy. She's also been a researcher at the RAND Corporation. She served in the Obama administration as a health advisor in the White House and also on Capitol Hill, where she served on the late Senator Edward Kennedy's staff and in the and among the senior staff of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which is the big committee that handles healthcare issues, along with finance. She will be moderating the first panel, and she'll be joined by Dana Matthew. Dana is a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings Center for Health Policy. She's also a professor at the University of Colorado School of Law, at the Colorado School of Public Health, and at the University's Center for Bioethics and Humanities. She was recently a Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Fellow in Washington and served in the office of Senator Debbie Stabenow. And last by no means least, she's the author of Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Healthcare. So let me hand over to
Me. I know, perfect. I think you're going to. All right, so thank you, Stuart, and welcome to everyone, both in person and watching on the web. And what we're hoping to do this morning, Washington, D.C. is sometimes filled with a lot of chaos, a lot of noise, but we know that what really emerges from that are voices that can actually bring stories forward and can help us not only to think at kind of a very high level, but also bring that back down to a very practical level. So this morning, I think we're going to very much take you through that journey. And so I'm excited to not only be a part of it, but also to join two of my colleagues. And what we're going to hope to do for the next half hour or so, I couldn't be more pleased. And I'll tell you candidly, I've known Stuart now for, it's probably been going, when I met you when I first worked for Ted Kennedy. And so it's probably been about 14 years, and Stuart is very kind of understated, but Stuart was one of the first people. He will be the first person to tell you that he's not a healthcare expert, but what he really is he's an expert in kind of thinking about our country's problems in a variety of directions. And so when I first met Stuart, it was actually on this very, seems like it's a very appropriate topic for today and for this year, just the topic of access, health insurance, but in the context of budgets. And so in my mind, when I thought about Stuart Butler, I always kind of thought, well, he's the budget expert. And it's been over the last several years that Stuart's applied that knowledge in thinking about kind of economic and budget issues to healthcare. And I think what's impressive to me is that somebody who, I'm trained as a doctor, so of course I think about healthcare all the time. Somebody like Stuart brings a background that's very diverse, and he has really identified, and we're eager to get into that this morning, how he applies some of his knowledge of thinking on a national scale, but acting at a local level, and then also taking that lesson from the local context to the national stage. And then I have to say that Professor Bowen Matthew, who's right next to me, Dana is also, as I was doing, you know, all of you are probably, you can Google all of us and see what Google brings up. Dana, I think, has been one of the preeminent scholars in really helping to push our thinking about health equity. Those terms sometimes feel very loaded, like, oh, health equity or community health or population health. What Dana's done over her career, and she's still young, so she's going to have more to do. What she's done over her career has been to really kind of push kind of consciousness about how our actual infrastructure of health really contributes to inequities in a serious way, but then how we can also be part of the solution. And because she comes at it from a legal perspective, she brings, by the way, this is like a limerick, you know, a budget expert, a lawyer, and a doctor, and somehow there's like a riddle to be found in all of this. But I think the fact that the three of us actually are all kind of interested in the same problem, I think it speaks so highly to, one, that this really is a community issue, that you can't find the answers in any of our traditional silos, and that, two, that there is really, I think there's a beautiful timing to this, because all three of us have come at this for very different reasons in our lifetimes, And I think there's just this great intersection. So I'm actually going to start, if you don't mind, Dana. Just, I'd love to have you, you have written both in book and in narrative, written beautifully about thinking about these intersections. And then I've read kind of, you know, when I was studying healthcare disparities, I really had a hard time understanding how to like bring that forward and how to think in my day-to-day life about healthcare equity and what we're doing to contribute to disparities unintentionally or how we contribute to inequities. Just speak a little bit about your work and also kind of knowing that this is a policy audience and there's people from the front lines here because I know some of you, and there's people who work in policy sectors, nonprofits. Help us understand what we can take away from this.
Sure. Thank you for the introduction. I love the part that I'm young.
You are.
I like that, especially. So this is a very knowledgeable audience, so I'll use some words that are probably known to everyone. But I originally come to the problem, as Kavita said, as a lawyer. And so lawyers are concerned with justice, a loaded word. Lawyers are concerned with equity and equality, not the same, but we're concerned with both of those. And so when I think about health on the population level, one of the things that concerns me most, both from the problem side and from the solution side, is inequity. Mm-hmm. Because if we don't appreciate that inequity means that resources needed to be healthy are inequitably distributed, then our solutions won't focus on the fact that that inequity will be exacerbated if we don't look at it. So when we look at neighborhoods and communities that are concentrated not only in poverty, but even modest income neighborhoods that have concentrations of under-resourced, so that would be food sources, educational opportunities because the poorest schools are located in the poorest neighborhoods, employment opportunities, built environment where people can exercise, exposure to hazards like pollution. So you were talking about stories, and one of the things we're working on right now in Colorado is something called the Interstate 70 Relocation Project. Well, this is in a neighborhood. It's called Elyria Swansea, where in the 1800s there was a smelting plant, so it's a Superfund site. There's a petroleum refinery. There is a pet food factory. There is the National Western Stock Show, and you know what comes with stock, located there. And now a 6-lane highway is going to be expanded to 8 lanes, right? So all of this is concentrated in a neighborhood. Now, you can guess the demography. Mm-hmm. Elyria Swansea is 84% Latino, and 44% of the people are under 400% of the federal poverty level. So this community is repeatedly assaulted from an external and internal health perspective. If we don't look at solutions that are going to address the inequities, both environmentally and physically, then that solution, that community will be left out and health disparities will continue there.
And so we're just a follow on, and then I want to bring Stuart in. What can we do? Because sometimes, you know, putting that kind of consciousness out there, it feels like it's so hard to understand kind of where to go from there. And I think that's personally been a struggle for me. So where can you, and I know you teach, you're kind of bringing on a next generation of legal scholars, and I would argue more interdisciplinary focused scholars. What are you trying to teach them, or what are you trying to have them take away from, like, kind of that I-70 experience?
So there are two things. One, we have to think, of course, everything to a lawyer looks like a legal problem. So
good company in D.C., by the way. A lot of people feel that way.
I would say there are two things. One of the things we're concerned about is more equitably distributing burdens and benefits. And then secondly, we're looking at new ways to pay for those benefits, right? Mm-hmm. So school financing is a great example. The way we do housing stock is another great example. One of the things that we have, this Colorado Health Equity Project, one of the things we're very concerned with is the fact that even though housing is becoming unaffordable in Colorado, we need to be thinking about mixed housing neighborhoods by zoning. That's a law. We need to be thinking about financing projects that will include multiple income families in one location. So these are legal problems and finance problems that I think we need legal and financing solutions.
And do you find that on our next panel, we're going to hear from one of the leaders kind of DC housing, so it'll be great to hear what's similar between Colorado and DC, and I know that there's a lot. Do you find that kind of also battling, you know, we call it NIMBYism, you know, there's certainly a sense of cultural kind of people feel very personal, obviously, about where they live. Have you encountered that or had experience with the attitudes of neighbors and neighborhoods?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason the I-70 corridor is a great example of this is because despite the poverty and the demography, this is a neighborhood where there are four generations of homeowners. So even though the highway project is going to displace 200 families, one of the questions is where are they going to go, right? So where are people who have had affordable housing going to go in Colorado, which is now one of the nation's fourth leading economy in terms of growth, right? Where are they going to go? Those neighborhoods are going to change, so social capital is going to change. That changes health, right? So social networks are going to change. That changes health. Availability of community affects health, and that's one of the things that I'm really excited about in terms of this conversation, that we understand that we're not talking about health anymore in an individual, what I call retail level, but we have to think about health in community so that we can affect populations like the population in Elyria, Swansea.
That's great. And so, Stuart, let me ask you to kind of jump in. And so I know maybe perhaps, Stuart, you can set up a little bit of what you've been leading, not only here at Brookings, but kind of the conversations you've been leading across different sectors to just give us some takeaways. Sure. And then also thinking about just I'll tee up, I know I can tee up hard questions for both of you, but also teeing up for you, Stuart, kind of what is your prescription per se? Kind of how can we think differently about these issues at a policy level?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for your very kind comments at the beginning. Well, I'm actually a historian by background, and so I would say, you know, the study of history is everything with examples. So that's kind of in general when I look at these issues, I tend to look across the spectrum and say what's involved in what helps us understand a particular issue. And as you also mentioned, one of the things I've been doing here at Brookings is bringing together, in fact, some of the panelists, bringing together a number of people from very different sectors to really brainstorm on how can we understand what's going on in health and also health in the economic sense of communities. Why do some people move up the ladder and others don't? How can we think about this and learn from each other and understand that to appreciate what happens in the health area, you've got to understand what's going on in these other areas, such as housing and transportation, as Dana mentioned. And we certainly have learned, if you look at the research in this area and the conversations we've had, we're certainly, I think, both here and in general, appreciating a lot more how these other non-medical factors influence healthcare. We're learning a lot about how what happens to a child in the early years, everything from stress to abuse and so on, can have long-lasting effects on healthcare. So if we can deal with some of those issues up front at the beginning, then we'll have a big payoff, so to speak, both for the child and for our costs later on. We know, as Dana has said, that housing can be really important. If you have substandard housing, it's very much linked to things like respiratory problems, other kinds of problems. I mean, obviously, lead paint, things like this we know about, but just dampness, poor neighborhoods, and so on. Falls, you think about the elderly. The Centers for Disease Control estimates that we spend probably about $30 billion a year fixing people who've fallen. And in many cases, this is an elderly person who's in an apartment, maybe with rugs that are slippery or with a bathroom that is not really well designed and it's more easy to fall and so forth. So a lot of these things are going on all the time. We also know that cultural issues are a factor. What's going on in a neighborhood, what the norms are, if people are smoking everywhere, you know, younger people start to smoke, that affects them a lot. So we know that there are a lot of connections between these factors and healthcare. So partly what I'm trying to do is to look at what could you do to intervene in certain ways to get these different sectors to start, first of all, to talk to each other. To share their insights, and to deal with a lot of the issues associated with where spending takes place. I mean, and let me just end on this. Take for example, this issue of falls among the elderly. You know, everybody knows, everybody can appreciate that if we could do something to reduce the level of falls, it would have significant effects on the number of elderly people who end up in the hospital and end up in long-term care.
Right.
Long-term care now, nursing home care, costs, the median in the United States now is $82,000 per year. So if you can prevent somebody ending up in a nursing home because, not because they want to be there, but because of a medical problem, right, you can not only improve their lives, but have considerable reductions in costs. But our system is not set up to say, okay, if it's going to cost us $82,000 over here, why don't we take some of that money and prevent the problem over there?
Right.
Because what, of course, we find is that programs are not designed to do that. You know, healthcare is healthcare, housing is housing. So how do we start to look at budgets in this way? How do we look at rules for payments and so on? That's what we're really trying to dig in. So we've got a problem here, I think, of we've got to both understand the contribution that social institutions and social services in the community have to improve health and reduce costs. We've got to understand that. And then we've also got to understand that we've got to actually take steps to get these different sectors to start to appreciate how they can help each other, and also to set up a budgetary and payment system, an incentive system,
right,
so that, you know, doing good is rewarded rather than very often penalized. When a hospital today does things that make it less likely that people will come to the hospital, that means their revenue goes down.
Right.
So, you know, this is not a... The chief financial officer does not see this as a particularly wise use of money, even though it makes sense to everybody. And that's the sort of thing we've got to really tackle.
And so I'll ask you a little bit of the same flavor question. How, because you've put out, and by the way, Stuart has been notorious for bringing these, I forget what you call them, like, is it strange bedfellows or,
working
you know,
groups.
It's like they're called the working groups, but I know
we've talked about
the fact that Stuart Butler is known for bringing together people who should have been having conversations with each other all along. And I will confess that, you know, I find myself when I've come to his working groups kind of sitting there going, I've never had conversations with people, you know, in housing or in some of these other social sectors. And I think that's been part of what's inspired a lot of our community-based work that we're doing even in the D.C. area. But one question for you, Stuart. We're at actually, I do believe that we're at a very interesting nexus because there is some shifts in payment policy, yeah, as you mentioned, to kind of promote these opportunities and have hospitals think very differently about care to be a bit more preventive, whether it's bundled payments, mm-hmm, or some sort of population health-based payments. So I know there are some financing mechanisms. Have you seen some other policy shifts that are allowing a little bit of that opportunity to think more preventive or upstream, so to speak?
Well, you're right that we've been taking some steps to kind of nudge these different sectors to work together a little bit. Some of them are sticks.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at, I was talking about the elderly, you look at Medicare, which now has, well, for some years now, has had a rule called the so-called readmissions penalty.
Right.
That basically says if somebody comes in for and is diagnosed with certain diseases, particularly heart disease and others, and then the hospital discharges that person, and then they come back into the hospital, or any hospital, within 30 days for the same diagnosis, that initial hospital faces a penalty, in some cases a substantial penalty. Well, that focuses the mind somewhat.
Right.
And so now we're
nothing
seeing
like dollars,
more and more
right.
hospitals saying, okay, let's engage in a little bit of follow-up service here.
Right.
Let's make sure that when we give that, you know, that wad of paper called the discharge, you know, saying do all this, do all that, that we actually just check up and make sure they do follow up with their GP, with their general practitioner, or even that we will go and see where they live and see if the fact they came in for a fall might be connected
to where they live.
Or right. maybe there's nothing in the fridge. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is a person that's just... has got, you know, it's two bus rides away from, you know, the grocery store and just doesn't eat properly. Let's see if we can begin to make that happen because we, the hospital, will face fewer penalties.
Right.
That's a stick. I mean, one would like to see more carrots.
Carrots,
and sticks,
right,
I
sure.
suppose.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, certain programs, the Medicaid program, particularly the managed care Medicaid program, where you've got managed care company or managed care projects that actually look across the sectors a little bit more, they're doing things to to address some of these issues of housing problems and so on in order to get mm-hmm. their general costs down. Health programs or health plans that are capitated, that have a membership fee or a capitated fee, certainly have an incentive to look at creative ways to use that money.
Right.
But there, and the rules for Medicaid are improving in that area. I think there's been a growing interest in connecting better between particularly the hospital sector, but the physician sector generally, and economic and community development a little bit better. And there are institutions, community development corporations, funders that are now looking at funding different types of activities and facilities to enable connections to be made more. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot of interest in using what we call intermediaries, those individuals who connect together different
the bridging.
Yeah, I mean,
of these,
a good example is a school nurse, right? For example, or a parish nurse, in churches, and say, how can we work together with these intermediaries who know the people in the church, have got skill sets in the medical area, to work with the hospitals and physicians together, and the same with school nurses.
Right.
And this means addressing issues like data, access to information, and so on, and licensing requirements, payment systems. These are all necessary to do that. But I'm glad to say I think we really are seeing a much greater interest in looking at these issues. We're not necessarily on a roll yet, but we're beginning to get close to being on a roll.
People are welcoming the conversation.
Absolutely, and I think there's a great opportunity at all levels of government.
Right.
To do this.
And that's what I was just going to ask you, Dana. So you really have spent time, especially in the last couple of years, at a national level and at a regional and local level. What shifts are you seeing? And then I couldn't be at Brookings, and I promised Stuart I wouldn't talk about like the ACA or the AHCA or any version of CA.
Oh, I didn't get that memo.
But you're right, Dana didn't get that memo, so I'm going to ask Dana. So Stuart and I are sick of talking about it. The truth is Stuart and I get asked about that on a daily basis, I think.
I'm so glad to be the outsider because I can claim ignorance.
So I am curious, though, Dana, just thinking about the local, regional, national, and the very real conversation we're having about just what kind of access points and how we should think about whether it's, you know, state budgets and per capita caps or, Medicaid allocations. How do you take the conversation we've been having for about a half an hour and then translate it to some of the challenges, you know, with access and then just even thinking through, you know, we're talking about potentially entering people into high-risk pools, and I would argue maybe that I-70 corridor is probably going to have a concentration potentially of people who are falling into that. So tell me, you know, even if you've just internally thought about this, how do you wrestle with that from an equity perspective? And what guidance can we give to people as they're also wrestling with these issues?
So thank you for
a real easy question.
Yeah, I was going to say
I'm going to let you talk to the United States Senate if you can figure this out. They need your help.
I think I'm going to focus on how we pay for things.
That's fine. Right? That's perfectly fine.
Because in fact, even as Stuart was saying earlier, there is a stick and a carrot approach, but all of it involves dollars. Right. All mm-hmm. of it involves how we reimburse payers. Now, some would argue that there's an over-medicalization of poverty and over-medicalization mm-hmm. of these social problems. And I really resist that and suggest that one of the shifts that we have seen, one of the heads of steam that we've seen, is that people in healthcare, physicians, providers, understand that, I think it was Rudolf Virchow that said this, it is self-evident that a physician or a provider's science must include everything, every aspect of life that is proclaimed purpose, that is health, touches, right? Everything. So it has to include housing, employment, income, and so forth. But it can only do so if we reimburse those providers in a way that gives them time and incentive to pay attention to those other factors. So one of the things that I've been writing about and thinking about is why hospitals, especially safety net hospitals, are not leading the charge to protect the Medicaid expansion, right? They should be leading the charge, not only because the head of steam that has allowed them to diversify their interest and create these collaborations that Stuart is so good at bringing people into the room, that should be happening on the ground, right? We should see more Catholic hospital initiatives working with Mercy Housing of Denver to create medical respites for the homeless, right? So that we can reduce the return and readmission. Why? Because there is a financial incentive to do so. We should see more collaboration between those who are addressing food insecurity, like the Boston Community Hospitals, right, that have both farmers markets that people can get to transportation-wise, as well as cooking classes, right, and educational components that will reduce chronic disease from a preventive side. But why don't we have this? We don't have it because we are still reimbursing per member per month, right? Mm-hmm. We're still reimbursing people in a way that incentivizes them to think about illness instead of wellness, mm-hmm. that incentivizes them to think about individual healthcare as opposed to population. And so I really do think that the leverage or the lever that we must address is making sure that financing is available. That's why I say hospitals should be leading Medicaid expansion, you know, the fight to protect it, whatever the, you know, political changes to the mm-hmm. ACA or whatever follows it. If we lose the ability to be creative about looking at bundled care, about alternative payment methods, if we lose the amount of money that is addressing vulnerable communities, then all of the head of steam is going to go backwards.
And I just may add a couple of things to that. I think one of the challenges, which flows from what Dana said, is first of all, it's hard for a physician to be knowledgeable about everything.
Right.
For example, now pediatricians are being urged more and more to ask children about their conditions at home, poverty, housing conditions, and so on. But they're not always sure what to do about with this information. So that's one of the reasons I think the role of intermediaries is really important. It's really important to have a kind of a cluster of people and organizations around the health system and really close partnerships so that when a physician spots a potential problem, they know how to give what we sometimes call a warm handoff to somebody to address this. And we're beginning to see this, hospitals, as that I mentioned, doing this. The second thing I think which is we're going to have to deal with and challenge is that, you know, what is the money spent on? When you look at something like Medicaid, I think an increasing issue is if we really wanted to do this effectively and to have the various aspects that lead to illness taken into account by the Medicaid program, we'd have to start using Medicaid dollars for different kinds of things than it traditionally has been used for. That makes a lot of people understandably nervous.
Right.
Does this mean that money intended for people's health is now drifting
right.
into other areas? What does that lead to down the road? We'd also want to have more flexibility generally about the use of that funding. Well, talking about the healthcare debate going on, there's a big debate over should states have greater flexibility in what they do with Medicaid. A lot of people get very anxious about that.
Right.
But the positive side, of course, is to say if they could, there could be a lot more exploration of ways of using what's now medical money to fix people in a way to deal with their health issues. These are difficult issues,
yeah. and
politically very. So it's. You know, we're on a roll in one sense, but it's a roll that's kind of bashing into
right.
some walls here
right.
and there as people right. think about what could go wrong with this
right.
picture.
The unintended
consequences. That's the issue,
right.
I think.
And I know Stuart's going to get into this with our concluding panel, so I don't want to steal too much of their thunder, but kind of the national implications. I mean, really, it goes back to, I think, Dana, what you put it very beautifully, this kind of I-70. I've driven on that highway. I know exactly what you're talking about, kind of this analogy, because we now are finding that our communities, in an ironic way, we're so connected because it's constant, you know, whether it's social media or this or that, and, you know, I told people, I finally joined the Facebook. For the longest time when I was in government office,
Facebook.
I could not, I was not on the Facebook, and my own mother kind of forced me to be on the Facebook because once you have children, it's the only way that she can see pictures of them, and so when I finally joined the Facebook, my sister sent me a text. This was literally like a couple weeks ago. She's like, welcome to 2008. So I am probably the worst connected person in the entire universe. But the irony is that the more connected we are, actually the more we're struggling with inequities across, I would almost argue, even more kind of more lines, that it's We're now seeing much more social isolation. We're seeing much more of a sense that even if you're in a community, there's a sense, and there's a very palpable sense in this country that you don't know where to go for help. And I don't know, you know, so I just, we're going to go to the audience in a second, and we've got two of my favorite people in the back with mics. So if you do have a question, I actually just want you to put your hand up so that we can get mics to you, and then I'll call on you. But Dana, just give us, I want to close out the panel before we get to the questions with just your thoughts on bringing it back to the community and kind of where you think, you know, you mentioned a little bit of kind of people in the built environment, food access, insecurity, employment. Kind of how do we think, is there a framework we can use to kind of think about, you know, is it bringing people together? What are some ways forward as a community that you would say, okay, we're doing it? I would say what Stuart's doing with his working groups is a great, you know, one potential. Are there some other things you've seen that work to just bring people together to solve these problems?
I'm afraid you've invited me to sort of wax lawyerly eloquent.
That's fine.
So
that's good.
I have to say I love your word connectedness, right? Because in a lot of ways, one of the things we've seen in the I-70 corridor is a lack of appreciation for how important it is for communities to connect. So I-70 is one of two interstates that goes through this historically Latino community, I-25 going north-south and I-70 going east-west. So that bisects the community, and that means people can create food solutions like a farmer's market up in the northwest corridor, but I got to take two buses and take off from work to get to that food solution. That community's not connected.
Doesn't matter.
And it doesn't matter that I've got this great food resource. That's what happened in Flint, quite frankly. Flint, we hear about the water crisis, but again, transportation, another health issue that's underappreciated, right? If you bisect the community, you put solutions out of the reach of a community, and then they have to use the fast food stores that are very dense and available.
And they're right there.
The bodegas, they're right there. We have got to think of connecting communities. And then lastly, sorry to get philosophical, but all communities are connected to one another.
Right?
We all bear the cost of premature death. We all bear the cost of excess emergency room visits and readmissions. We all bear the cost of under-resourced, low and modest income communities. And if we think that we can isolate those problems from the whole, then we're missing the picture.
Great, perfect. And I know we've got some questions. Yes, sir. Just if you can tell us who you are and just your question.
Okay, I'm a student at Howard University. My name is Jordan Sellers. I liked you all's narrative. This is kind of like the wedding before the funeral. But in terms of what she said specifically about how can we alternate solutions to this problem as far as healthcare is concerned, it seems that there still needs to be a study done given the fact that healthcare for males or females is kind of the same thing nowadays. We're talking about, okay, whether you're a married couple or single or you're a heterosexual or homosexual couple, we're talking about the same needs and wants. So really, how do you, I guess, say that there isn't a problem with healthcare if you're giving the same type of healthcare to people in the healthcare community and there really is no debate and argument from them?
I'm not sure I'm smart enough to know what that question was asking right now. So you're talking about how do we know if there is truly a difference in healthcare between persons? I just want to make sure.
So the analogy was like this is the wedding before the funeral. So if you're going to provide healthcare for couples, whether they're homosexual or heterosexual, it's like healthcare is trying to get them premium healthcare if they are already, you know, celebrating something that's going to benefit this particular couple, but they're not giving them long-term healthcare if there's going to be, like I said, a wedding before the funeral, life or death that could happen. So it's like, where are we going with solving this problem if the social science isn't saying that healthcare as it's being provided doesn't cover life to death?
Oh, I see. Okay. Sorry. Now I understand. All right. So do any of you want to just tackle kind of thinking about, I'm just going to kind of paraphrase a little bit just to give a pointed question. Just how do we think about the need for the kind of longitudinal, and that's where I think you were arguing that we need to actually study this, that we're looking at healthcare in kind of different time constraints before what is really a longer-term vision for healthcare.
Well, we certainly, I think, some years ago began to recognize that health is a continuous process, which is what I think we're getting at. Because when you have a health system, for example, that's of heavily and still is heavily employment-based, for example, the incentives for an employer thinking about what health to give to their to their employees is going to be different from somebody looking at that whole period. So as we've tried to move towards healthcare being connected to the person rather than where they happen to be or where they happen to work, that's, I think, been a very important step forward. We've also been doing a lot more research in over the years now in looking at what when you intervene at a certain point or if something bad happens at a certain point, how does that affect people over the long term?
Right.
And what can we do in these areas? And I think that's been one of the reasons that, particularly with regard to, say, children, that this focus on social determinants and what goes on in those neighborhoods has attracted the interest of people in the healthcare community, not just the social science community or the sociology community, because it does have these long-lasting effects. It's the same as the debate over early childhood education. Where does the benefit show up? Is it long-lasting? Is it short? And so forth. So I think in general, we've seen the healthcare system or people researching in the healthcare system and practicing in the healthcare system, like these other sectors, like education, like social science and so forth, beginning to look at this continuum. And I think that's the core, in a way, of what we're talking about here today in this panel. What are these issues that, and factors that influence are going on in these early in the early period that may end up, you know, causing the wedding to be a funeral or causing problems or leading to a really good outcome? And how do we learn from that?
And I think the question, I think you're exactly right that we don't really set up studies or think about things in that longitudinal way. I know
we're getting better.
We're getting better. I mean, Stuart and I know this. Stuart probably doesn't even remember this. When I worked for Kennedy, one of the things that I approached you and Hank Aaron here at Brookings about was the fact that we couldn't actually get the Congressional Budget Office to think that way when we were looking at interventions that would have an effect, early interventions, you know, even on a healthcare front that could have those downstream
researchers,
effects.
Like everybody else, tend to be rather siloed. It's difficult, even within the health area, to get people to really focus on the long term. When you start saying, okay, if I'm a health analyst, how do I start thinking about housing and education? So literally, people in these fields often have really very little knowledge about the databases, about the research in these other sectors. And so actually looking at the return to an investment of focusing on something which is non-health, non-medical, in order to improve the health over the long term. Sometimes it's actually very difficult to find somebody who looks across those sectors to know what the data is, to get the kind of research needed. And that's kind of where we are now, I think, trying to find better ways of looking at returns on investment across sectors to show the impact on health.
I want to just say in response to the question, I don't know if you meant to, but you put me in mind of one other thing that we don't talk a lot about, and that is the community's role in defining research objectives. And the community's role in defining what kind of healthcare choices we make. One of the things I appreciated so much about being in Senator Stabenow's office during the Flint water crisis was that the first call our staff made was to people in the community to say, what can we do to help you? And some of the answers were not what we expected, right? So some of the things that we needed to research were not exactly what we would have done in our own Ivy Tower kind of research generating. You know, we would come up with different solutions if we asked the populations that we're serving.
And people don't even take the time to do that. That's your point.
That we don't.
Very few people.
I don't know if you meant to say, but when you asked that question, I was thinking, well, sometimes I just go in my corner and I think about what I want to research, and really I'm driven by what data sets I can get, and that's what I'm going to research. We need to ask people who we're serving.
And flipping that model to bring the kind of data we need is actually something we're going to get into a little bit. So let's go over here to this side, and then we'll flip to this side, this lady on the end.
I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician. I'm also an attorney. What you're talking about are called the social determinants of health. And there's been lots of study of that. And, of course, overseas in Europe, they do it much better. What I'm concerned about is for-profit, not-for-profit. I think we are medicalizing things that shouldn't be medicalized. The difference between the visiting nurse service, VNA, and for-profit home health agencies. In VNA, though it used to be, at least when I was using it, a nonprofit, it was an institution where the nurses and the people who weren't nurses, they had a promotion scale, they had benefits, they had teaching and learning, so that you could advance your career moving up, and it was not for profit. A home health agency, which often provides the same kinds of services, they take immigrants, they give them a couple of weeks of training, they have no benefits, they have no future, it's a dead-end job. When they're disabled because they've tried to move a heavy person, they've taken out their backs, I had patients like this, they're just discarded, and new people are brought in, and all the intermediaries make money. The people who run the agency, the hospitals who employ them. We need to build community institutions like VNA, sort of like the nation building that we did in Afghanistan. People need to work with the community to set up nursing, social work, that everyone can access and everyone supports. The hospital shouldn't be doing population health. Population health is a public health problem. The solution to obesity is not talking to your doctor, but like tobacco. Public health initiatives, reducing advertising, putting calorie counts on food. That's something that President Trump just withdrew, or the FDA under President Trump just withdrew. Think about profit, nonprofit, and community institutions, which I understand is what they have in Europe.
Any reactions? Any just thoughts?
Well, I think our emphasis on what we're talking about here, and certainly the work we're doing here at Brookings and elsewhere, is very much focused on those institutions. I'm not absolutely convinced it's a profit, non-profit issue so much as one where how do you actually get the incentive structure and skill sets in place to enable a good outcome. I think particularly with regard to community-based institutions, we're seeing an improvement and addressing some of the issues associated with education and training of, say, nurses to play different roles and more expansive roles in the community. I think we're looking at how to get better partnerships with exactly those institutions you referred to in those communities. That is the kind of thing we're doing, and I think where the effort is being placed to address those specific issues that you raised. You're absolutely correct about the ingredients, the things that are need to happen, and to begin to kind of work in that area. I think whether it's a federal issue so much, we'll get into a bit later about mm-hmm. to what extent it is the place to see these things moving more locally and thinking of ways of permitting it to happen, removing things that get in the way may be an important factor. And I'd just say finally that I think there's a lot of interesting experimentation and initiatives about more localized efforts to build a village, to build a team in this way. We see it with things like community schools and communities in schools, which is setting a team in the school to look at these different things and to try to work together. We see it here in the District of Columbia and also in Boston and a few other places in the growth of senior villages, which are institutions in the community, a mixture of volunteers and some professional staff to really address the multiple needs of elderly people trying to age in their home and addressing right. all these issues. So I think it's coming. I think you're absolutely right to emphasize those concerns. But I think the good news is that we're beginning to see some activities in these areas and some institutions growing to address the kind of items that this questioner asked.
Any brief thoughts, or should we just move on to get
I see the word brief. I just want to say
I
one
know.
Thing.
I'm trying. I just want to get as many folks in.
I absolutely respect your experience. I want to push back just a little bit. It doesn't have to be hospitals. Stuart and Cameron...
although I'm here to tell you they have money they should be giving. So I'm just going to be an advocate that hospitals should play a role because they should. But
Okay, well, that's
we'll get into this in the next panel.
She did it for me.
Exactly.
Hospitals don't have to, but they are a hub, to use Stuart and Cameron's word, that is a really good choice and possibility. Not the only choice.
Right.
Schools could be a hub. The point is to bring collaboration around public health problems. There is no institution alone that can do it, and no institution is absolved from it doing it.
That's right.
Is my point. And so I'll leave it there, and maybe we'll have a conversation offline about my clients who are also patients, and will only come to see the lawyer in the clinic. They will only come to see the social worker in the clinic. So the clinic, the healthcare provider, is a hub that the community respects and that the community relies on. And so to bring those services into the public health services into the clinical space is very effective.
Gentleman over here in the front, and then I'm going to try to make sure we can get to everybody. So we're going to try to be very brief. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Sandy Apgar, CSIS in Brookings Metro. Have any of your study groups or programs looked specifically at the best performing non-U.S. programs to really identify practically what works, what doesn't? The structural differences are fairly well known, but having spent almost 10 years in the UK in the last decade and actually experienced and lived the National Health Service and so forth. As a capitalist, I came back very much geared to a national single-payer system in the way they've performed it. But although I've seen studies but have not focused, as you all have, about the NHS and its counterparts in other countries, I've never seen a direct business-like clinical comparison of the practical levers of what makes them work and what is somewhat dysfunctional. The three observations I would make as a former client, patient, and so forth in that system. First, ours is far more complex for the individual consumer and patient.
We now know that.
And right? The obverse of complexity, of course, is simplicity, as any business knows. Complexity breeds cost. It's inherent. And when you begin to simplify complex systems, you can carve out costs. The second is specialization. Our system seems to be so specialized that alone for a general patient or consumer client is a real problem. And it gets in the way. The silo effect is very obvious. The third is institutionalization. As distinct from individualization, we felt very much individual healthcare consumers and patients in the UK, much more than we do. And finally, cost consciousness, which is all of the above three, tend to diffuse the attitude toward cost. It still is phenomenal to me that when a general practitioner or specialist recommends X as a procedure, and I ask, what's it going to cost us? He or she cannot respond.
Right.
And if they do, it's always with 10 caveats. Well, we don't need that as individual consumers. We need people who deliver care who, yes, know it is costing $1,000 or $10,000 or $50,000 and then can be aware of that. So observations plus the question.
All right.
Question.
Do you want to just take that briefly?
As a resident expert.
Exactly. I hear your accent, so I'm
spent a little time in the National Health Service. I think you're certainly the last part of your question, your observation is right on in terms of what some of the differences are. I think there have been a lot of studies that have looked at, you know, medical cost effectiveness across and medical systems across the world. Much less on what goes on in communities that has these implications, which is similar to here. And we're not as aware of that. When you look at that, there's also cultural issues that you've got to sort of try to factor in. Certainly when I spent many years in the UK under the NHS, and the role, for example, of the local district nurse, which is a person, an individual in the National Health Service, which is kind of virtually unknown here. It's a little bit like a parish nurse. Like,
yeah.
You know, we're groping towards it here. But this was a nurse, a highly trained nurse in the community, whose job it was to make everything fit together. And not only within the medical sector, but dealing with other sectors. My mother used to run a post office in the UK many years ago. And the district nurse would come by her every day to get intel
on what was going on in the community. Mrs. Jones, who normally came in every Tuesday, hadn't come in. So the district nurse would literally bicycle off to see if Mrs. Jones was okay. And sort of, you know, that's something we don't really have here. But that's a central feature of the NHS, irrespective of whether you think, you know, single payer is better. Or we don't have people like this. And then I would just say, yes, you're right in your first point about we in many ways in the United States are the most overregulated and the most highly regulated system. Simplicity counts for a lot. Simplicity, flexibility. I mean, complex rules are the enemy of flexibility. Right? You just literally cannot do certain things. And that's so often what we encounter here. And it's dealing with that is part of the solution. And giving flexibility and reducing restrictions, it doesn't mean you get substandard quality for exactly the reasons that you mentioned.
Dana, final thought, and then we are... I know there were other questions. Some of these themes will come up in the next two panels, so just please reserve, and we'll try to get to you in the next two panels. Just final thoughts to kind of round us out.
I'd like to end by saying I'd love to see private and public streams of financing come together to address this problem. My favorite model is social impact bonds right now. Crazy about social impact bonds. They do wonderful things for food in Brockton, Massachusetts, and so forth. But I think what Stuart has called it is, and he's not the only one, of course, but I've really been impressed by the writing that he's done about braiding and blending public and private streams of financing, because we have to be able to do this apart from government regulation. We have to be able to do this at various levels of community. And so looking at ways for the two sectors to combine would be a really good solution to start with.
Well, join me in thanking both Stuart and Dana. Thank you. And we're gonna do a little bit of just stage choreography, exit left, come right, that type of thing.
Thank you.
And we're just going to be waiting, and I'm just grabbing.
I'm going to sit right there, Adrian. So, yeah, you're right next to me, and Matt,
you can go. You can just sit next to me. Yeah, that's good. I'll be right. I'm going to be over here. So I just have to grab. All right. Let me grab. Sorry, I left my papers because I'm going to join you on your seat here. There, I have my notes. I want to make life easier. You teed it all up for us in this last.
I know.
I shouldn't try to. You always remind me I shouldn't try to do what I don't know. Thank you. All right, so welcome. It's me again. You're like, why is that lady in orange always on the stage?
You shift places.
I did. Yes. I moved over. So this is actually going to be, there's no, you know, this is going to be a very fun conversation. Not because the problems are easy, but I can't think of three better people to tackle what the last panel teed up, but at a very, like, let's get real kind of, you know, like we're just going to be very honest, including, I think, where there are just, I'll be the person that kind of vocalizes, like, God, what are we doing? You know, some days I wake up and I'm like, what are we doing? You know, this is, so how we can get there. But I'm really excited because the District of Columbia, the home we're in, I've now been a resident of D.C. for you know, 15 years almost. And in a way, I think Dana's so eloquent. She put it best that, like, we're not very connected. And so part of what I'm very grateful for is that as a clinician in the District of Columbia, I started noticing over the years that I just really saw this lack of connectedness result in really, in my little neck of the woods, really severe healthcare problems. I see people in an ambulatory primary care clinic setting, and I really struggled, and I even told Paula, I'm going to introduce people briefly, but I feel like these are friends. I would talk to each of the people, you know, in different ways on this panel, about the struggles. And I'm very thankful to the Aetna Foundation because, to be honest, without kind of this public-private and intersection of philanthropic support, support from the District of Columbia, support from even our own hospital at Johns Hopkins, I honestly couldn't see a way forward to try to bring a community together. And I'll just start. What I want to do is just make sure I introduce each of these people. They have their formal titles. I will read them because that's important. But I'm going to tell you just a little bit about each one of them, something that you probably wouldn't have necessarily guessed from their titles. So I'm Kavita Patel. You all know me. And then starting at your left is Paula Reichel. She's the Advocacy and Nutrition Education Director for the Capital Area Food Bank. But what I will tell you that title does not speak to is that Paula is truly one of the connectors, not just in D.C. I'm going to let her talk about the Capital Area Food Bank, but she is one of the connectors in such an important way in a very large geographic region for Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. And one of the few women I know, very young, but so mature in her years, because she really does bring kind of all of these complex thoughts and hard questions into a very practical way of thinking about food insecurity. And I will tell you, like, you know, if any of you are family members, parents, loved ones, nothing, I mean, once you start kind of talking about someone being hungry, that's where the conversation stops. Mm-hmm. You can't talk to them about anything else because that feeling of gnawing, that hunger overrides everything. So Paul is truly a hero in my book. Matt Brown, who also has like a very nice title, geriatric nurse navigator at Sibley Memorial Hospital, does not do him justice either because he's one of the people in a hospital-based setting who is what I would argue leading kind of this call to doing better in the community. And he, whether his colleagues like it or not, pushes the limits on how we think about not only transitions out of the hospital, but how we really think about people honestly staying out of the hospital and doing it in a way that gives them the best chance at productivity. And I can truly say Matt is kind of helping to step in for a community partner who had to actually do some work with the District of Columbia around aging. And so Matt, who is a geriatric nurse by training and actually practices this in a daily setting, Matt is going to speak, I hope, to what he and I overlap in working in the District of Columbia and trying to understand how does the hospital play a role. And then also pushing, he and I can speak very honestly. I can, because I'm not afraid of any of my superiors. I mean, there are many days where I go to our CEO of our hospital and tell him he has to do better. I mean, this is not, it's not acceptable for me to see, you know, millions of dollars in hospital budgets, be they for-profit or not-for-profit, and then one small, infinitesimal, minuscule portion of that goes into the community. So that's not acceptable. Our CEO at Johns Hopkins agrees that it's not acceptable. But then getting that translated to the CFNO and the other like C-suite leaders is absolutely like what makes Matt and I, you know, that's like our daily living, right, Matt?
You see so the
that's
camera. Right?
I do see the camera. I'm not afraid.
I'm just kidding.
There's something that comes with a little bit of age where you just don't care anymore. Yeah. You're just like, I'll have a job somewhere. Someone will hire me. It's okay. I'm not afraid to speak truth to power. And then finally, so Adrienne's title also, it's very fancy, Executive Director of the District of Columbia Housing Authority. What the title doesn't necessarily convey is that Adrienne is probably one of the few people who also, she sits in these healthcare conversations, she's patient, she kind of stomachs this, and she is kind of like itching to kind of burst out of the gates to really talk about not just where housing kind of has a role in all these things we're talking about, but how much she's fighting in the kind of silos of housing policy to do exactly what we're talking about. So all these same conversations, as Stuart kind of mentioned, are the ones that you're having as well. So the one I just want to do, in the District of Columbia, there's so many things going on, but one of the things that we're working on is actually kind of trying to connect, and then I'll tell you a little bit about this to tease it up, but then I'm actually gonna start with Adrienne and kind of work our way down. One of the things that we're doing in the District of Columbia, kind of with the support of the Aetna Foundation, has been to actually try to connect community partners. One, it's really to focus on high-risk populations, And I'll tell you what's interesting. When we went out and tried to talk to people about what does, quote, high risk mean, it was very fascinating to listen to people of very different backgrounds talk about things, including patients. We asked patients, like, do you think that it's a, you know, do you feel like you're worried about your health care? And what was very interesting is kind of the different responses we get. Well-validated literature, and what I used to start the conversation was, if you've been in the emergency room or if you've been admitted, and Matt and I kind of start with those conversations because we see people being admitted to the hospital. We see people going to the emergency room many times. Interestingly enough, though, patients and community partners identified things like loneliness. If people feel lonely, people feel worried that they're going to die in the next year. There were a lot of things that people identified themselves that classified them as high risk that our conventional medical literature wouldn't have even put into a journal. So we are learning more, and what we're hoping to also kind of really embark on in this next phase is how to do the reverse. Paula and some of the other partners, we've talked about flipping the model a little bit because, as Stuart mentioned, his mother in the post office knew more about what happened in people's health care or in their daily lives than any doctor ever could. And so when we get to Paula, I'm hoping she'll touch on the fact that they're going to be hosting the Capital Area Food Bank as a community partner. They're hosting kind of this Health and Hunger Summit next week. But they're also trying, and I'll be honest, I've worked with her field coordinators, and they do a much better job identifying who they're worried about that might be, quote, high risk. But I would never have seen them, and they might never have had an access point with a conventional medical institution. So we're trying not only to kind of do things better in the healthcare setting, but we're trying to flip that and have the community partners really identify where they can help to, you can call it hotspotting, health compass, some way of identifying kind of what's vulnerable in your communities. So let me stop there. Adrian, there's so much to kind of touch on. First, just tell us a little bit about kind of what you're doing from this framework of housing, and especially tell us, educate our audience. We've got a lot of smart people here, but educate us a little bit in kind of some of the constraints you find in DC housing and where you see some of what we talked about in that last session kind of coming true to what we're doing in the district.
Sure. Good morning, everyone. So as a houser, we really focus in on the built environment, and things like working with healthcare institutions comes as cherry on the top of the cake. But we think about what is our responsibility to a healthy neighborhood. And we were doing this way before neighborhoods became sexy again in the past 3 or 4 years. Like back, way back in the 90s, we began to look at our public housing communities as being unhealthy for a variety of things. Not just the lack of access to amenities and good healthcare, but just the built environment itself, the units that people were living in, and also just what it meant to have a socioeconomic group that was impacted in terms of just the level of poverty there in the neighborhood. So we began to look at our communities differently as housers, not knowing that our end goal would be building healthy neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. We just needed to fix the units. And what we found from that work in the late 90s to today is that smart researchers have now followed a lot of our work and said, wait a minute, neighborhoods matter. Look at what happens when you take an impacted community and you make it mixed income and you create different amenities for the neighborhood. We have a great site here in the District of Columbia named Sheridan Station, which is in Ward 8, which was a really dysfunctional public housing site for some time. Not the people, but the units were just falling apart. And then we redeveloped it, and today it is a thriving 300-unit community. We brought back many of the families that used to live there. We have a clinic on site, but what we've created is a place where people are not afraid to be, bring their friends, the pizza people will show up, and it's really created a much more healthy environment. And as a houser, that is just one strategy in terms of creating healthy communities. We have two other strategies that we use. The one that many people in this room is probably familiar with is how do you institute a mobility strategy for families? If the neighborhood is unhealthy, how do you move people into healthier neighborhoods? So one of the things that all housing authorities do, we're very fortunate to be able to toggle between creating a place-based situation, but also a mobility initiative. So we have our housing choice vouchers. And here in DC, we're very, very fortunate. If you're a local DC person, we also have a local voucher program that we should all be very thankful about. And in those programs, we are able to move families from neighborhoods that they don't want to live in into other neighborhoods that may have stronger schools, better amenities, and better social networks for the family in terms of where they want to, the trajectory that they want their kids to go. But it's very expensive to do that.
Yeah.
That's a very expensive strategy. And even here in D.C., whereas HUD will give us what's called a payment standard, a fair market rent of 100%, here we've had to push the value of our voucher up by 75% so that we can afford even the neighborhoods that we were once in 10 years ago, Shaw being a great example.
Yeah.
So while these strategies all have different value orientations to it, some people feel like we shouldn't be moving families out of their neighborhoods, that they should be able to really invest in the current neighborhoods. We're also invested in neighborhoods, but they all cost money. And you know, we can talk about a little bit later about what that means for all of us in this room for being ambassadors for affordable housing.
Right, because to be pragmatic, there's hard choices with that. I mean, the money is actually dwindling. I mean, there's
right.
real serious budget issues
right.
that are causing you to have to make decisions, obviously. And so, you know, we'll go through everyone, but I just
sure.
want to plant for you kind of thinking about, you know, we had this conversation about healthcare resources. Have you, in a time of really honestly creative budgeting, thought about what does this mean if we think differently about healthcare dollars and allocations of resources? So I'll let you think
sure.
about that. Matt, go ahead and just, I'd love for you, if you don't mind, I know that I set this up in many ways. I would love for you to just talk a little bit about the work you've done and thinking about not just the hospital serving kind of as a little bit of a hub, which we referenced in the last session, but also kind of what could hospitals be doing better? You know, what do we need to do a better job at doing in thinking about kind of this notion of communities, connectedness? And then I know Matt's gone into, you know, Stuart actually didn't realize this. He set it up pretty nicely. Matt's actually gone into patients' homes who have kind of been discharged and give us a little flavor of what those insights have given you and kind of what we can learn from that.
All right. Thank you for having me. I have 10 years, celebrating 10 years as a nurse today, and I've got an award reception tonight. So getting
oh, wow.
to knock
oh,
out two occasions in a suit and tie when you're used to working in PJs.
Matt. I know, I never see him in a suit.
She's giving me a hard time.
I almost didn't recognize him.
Yeah. But with that, with the pajama comment aside, I am honored to be a nurse and be a part of a really special profession. And with a microphone and with an audience, I will say, applause
right.
for nurses, because it's
that's
it's
right.
No,
I'll clap for that.
Grateful to be a part of it. To your question, I've done not as many home visits as I've done follow-up phone calls. And when Stuart was talking about the fall, I will never forget, and I bet I've told this story a dozen times, but the very first follow-up phone call I made was a guy that I'd gotten to know for a week in the hospital, and I was checking in on him at home, and I called him, and he's hemming and hawing on the phone a little bit. And I'm like, Bob, are you okay? Is everything all right? And he said, I think so. I said, you think so? What do you mean? He said, well, I fell. And I'm like, oh, boy.
Oh.
So I'm a nurse, you know, falls are obviously terrible. And he said, well, I'm not sure because I'm still on the ground. I said, Lord, Bob, you got to call 911. He said, no, my wife will be home in a couple hours. I said, is she going to be able to pick you up? And he said, no, probably not. And I said, well, you got to call 911. He's like, and he's back and forth with me because he didn't want to come back into the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, is the door unlocked? And he said, well, no. I said, so not even got to kick the door in. They'll come in, pick you up, dust you off, check your vitals, and be on the way. And I said, and if you don't call, I'm going to call 911, and then I'm going to call your wife.
Right.
So he did, and I actually called back and got to speak to the EMTs and make sure he was okay. But in that example, that first call, I learned that people don't understand the severity of that time mm-hmm. when you're discharged to home, how much can go wrong, and how on high alert you need to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a home visit, would go with our former head of the hospitalists, and we're in the home, and the guy had gotten his meds filled, which that right there, people can't always do that, but he had his medications, and they were on the table, and he was on the exact same drug, same pill as his wife, and the pills are, like, right here. And all it takes is one cat walking by, and they're mixed up. And he was able to show us and talk through, but he had it by bottle. So we had to spend some time with him to educate him on we need to space these out and separate them and make sure that he understood the severity of taking the meds. And I think nurses would tell you we could do better at discharge from the acute care setting to home to do that teaching. And they would also be quick to tell you more nurses would help with that. I'm not up here to talk about nursing shortages or fix any of that, obviously, but I think the other thing we run into in that transition from acute care to home is as soon as people hear discharge, they're gone. Their readiness to learn is not there. They're cleaning their inbox, they're getting groceries, they're not ready to listen. So I think we need to approach education from a multifaceted, multimedia, meet people where they are, where they're ready to learn. And we know the best discharge starts on admission, but we also know that you start talking about discharge too early, you can get people wound up, they're not ready to go home. So I think we need to be meeting them where they are, whether it's one of the things I'm working on at the hospital now is getting patient education videos sent to patients on their email so that they could watch them when they get home or they could watch them prior to their surgery. And I think just trying to have things in place like to catch them, whether it's a phone call, whether it's we're sending them with an iPad to FaceTime with somebody, or ideally you have them enrolled for that 2 weeks in one of the villages and somebody's able to pop by and put eyes on them. Just have them be caught, because I think people don't realize how critical that time is and how much they really need to be on higher alert.
Can you talk about what the villages are, just because people might not know?
Oh, sorry.
Just a very brief description, because I do think it's a good example of where communities have come together, especially in the district, kind of truly on a voluntary basis to help out. But then what the hospital does to be a part of that.
They're based on neighborhoods, and so it's networks of volunteers, and there's a paid person who sort of coordinates all the services, but they, based on your neighborhood, you can pay a subscription fee, which helps maintain the organization of it. And then you can get not necessarily clinical things, but like a light bulb change, a trash taken out, somebody to drive you to medical appointments, like a nice non-clinical neighbors helping neighbors. And it's awesome. And I wish they were bigger, and I wish we could.
And we've been paying, so just to be candid, because I forget the amount because we pay for it, but it's something like, I want to say, $50 a month. But we know that there's no amount that's an easy amount to pay, especially when you're living on that margin and it's making a decision to pay your electricity bill or to be a part of a village. So the hospital and actually our clinics, we're subsidizing kind of memberships into the villages so that people can have access to transportation and some of these other, and to help fix, like Matt's example of the light bulb is a very common one where people just need help around the house, and that poses significant barriers. So I highlight that because it's a really good example of where both philanthropic dollars, hospital-based resources can be allocated for a community-based resource that helps bring connectedness within like an actual neighborhood. And so that's one of the models that's kind of a nice example. I, as the finance kind of healthcare person, try to think, how do we find a sustainable way to integrate that into the way we pay for healthcare? So we're doing this right now on the backbones of nonprofits, philanthropic organizations, and the hospital. But how do we actually create that into like the bundled payment for orthopedics or something like that? So thank you, Matt. Paula, so I've set it up for you to close out this all-star panel a little bit, but first tell us about the work you're doing and then really drive home. I think each one of us are trying to bring it back to something local. Mm-hmm. Really talk, you educate me constantly on just how hyper-local all of this is, but talk about food insecurity and then this intersection of health and hunger. And
absolutely.
Plug your summit, please.
Oh, you're
because,
so wonderful.
we're 100% going to make sure people are going to be a part of that next Thursday as well.
Thank you, Kavita, and thank you for that lovely introduction. When I'm feeling having a bad day, I will reflect
you
back
will.
On that.
Just watch the webcast over and over again.
So I am a part of the Capital Area Food Bank. We're the region's largest anti-hunger organization. We reach 540,000 people across the metro area. That's 12% of our region's population. So just to give you a thought about and some thinking around our scale. And we reach them with 46 million pounds of good food. And I'll come back to that idea of pounds and why that's such an important inflection and reflection point for us. But we're essentially a neighborhood-based organization, and we're rooted in the community through our 444 community-based nonprofit organizations. And those organizations are the ones who access our food, distribute it, have those local relationships, have those neighborhood-based relationships. And most of them are small, volunteer-run nonprofits. So we're not talking about, like, high-capacity organization. We're talking about, like, a very committed church volunteer and a couple other folks who run a food pantry every other Sunday, maybe two weeks out of the month. So that forms the basis of how we operate. And when we don't have a partner, we look to place targeted direct food services into the community. And so as an institution, we're well over 30 years old, but we don't look it. but for our entirety of our 30 years, as well as the majority of the nation's 200 food banks, we've been driven primarily by one metric, and that's output in terms of pounds of food distributed. But we know that not all pounds are created equal. Soda is a lot heavier than leafy greens. I know because we actually harvested 2 pounds of leafy greens out of our garden just the other day. And to think about how much is 2 pounds of leafy greens versus maybe a 2-liter bottle of soda. And so knowing that, and also knowing the rate of incidence of chronic disease in our community, high rates of diabetes, high rates of heart disease, high rates of obesity, and that food can be a solution, and that food can be an equalizer for members of the community, we've really stepped up and evolved our approach into what we're calling 21st century food banking. And 21st century food banking is where we address hunger needs while also improving the health and well-being of the communities we serve. And so we've gone through this process and evolution in our thinking about how we operate. And I just want to walk through the steps a little bit so you get an idea of how this looks like on the ground. So the first thing we did was we really bought in all members of our constituencies, the people we serve, the organizations we work with, and most importantly, our food donors. So we really wanted to turn the myth on its head that food donors just perpetuate the problem. We've actually been able to engage them to come up and join us on our path toward a more healthy, well community. So they're a part of the solution. So another piece of how we've operationalized this is by focusing first on what we do, which is food acquisition, food movement, distribution, logistics, all the things that are not quite as sexy, and a lot of it is behind the scenes. And so to do that, we actually had to start from scratch and say, hey, what's in our inventory? We distribute 46 million pounds of food per year. What is the nutritional quality of that food? And we actually had to come up with a wellness tracker. Our in-house dietitian developed it that looked at the amounts of sugar, salt, and fiber in our foods. And we're able to categorize our food as wellness or non-wellness. And that was really critical. That was just a few years ago where, for the first time, we knew the nutritional quality of our inventory, and that's enabled us to really set goals to improve that quality and to have conversations with upfront, frank conversations with food donors. We've also rethought nutrition education. So in the past, nutrition education is, you know, your six-week classes where you're engaging a small, targeted group of people. You're having a major impact in your lives, but you're asking for a big commitment. And so we really, you know, knowing our scale and knowing what we do best, wanted to refocus our nutrition education around how do we shift and improve health behaviors for folks. How do we send out a pound of food, but we also send it out with key messages that help folks transform that pound of food into healthy, affordable meals for their family. And so, I like to give the example of a banana. It's great to know how much potassium is in a banana, but is that really going to make a difference to your everyday life? No. Well, I want to know, how do I store the banana? How do I maximize its shelf life? What are some great recipes to use bananas in a savory way for my family, or turnips, or other fruits and vegetables that we may not be familiar with? So that's where we focused our energy around nutrition education. And finally, and I think this connects more to what Kavita is mentioning and the sort of the context of this panel, we've come to the realization that we can't do this alone. Even though we are a large established network, we are not the only ones who are solving food insecurity, who are improving community-based health. So we've made a thoughtful effort to engage anchor institutions in the community. First, we're engaging schools. So we actually have food services and food programs in 73 schools about, across the metro region, and particularly in elementary schools where we know parents are most likely to shift their behaviors, and we're setting students up for a lifetime of success. So we're sort of creating and helping to be a part of that, creating their health behaviors. We're also partnering with grocery stores. So we want to build a bridge to retail. 56% of the people that we're working with are working. They have earned income, in addition to potentially using SNAP dollars. So we want to see them be able to utilize their dollars in an effective way in the store to be able to create the most healthful meals for their family. And finally, and this points to what we're talking about next week on May 18th, 8:30 to 11:30, come and see me if you're interested. We want to crack the nut on healthcare. How do we integrate with healthcare institutions? How do we make food a focus for people who are in a clinical capacity? And, you know, this is such a learning experience for me as well, because healthcare is just, it's a very complicated field. And so for the past 3 or 4 years, we've just been having frank conversations with healthcare providers and saying, this is the problem. How do you see us working together to address it? And that's taken many forms, whether it be integration in the clinical setting, so sort of having food pantries or maybe food boxes at discharge as a part of a procedure and as a part and including a food insecurity screening. Or maybe it's the reverse. Maybe it's embedding health services in our points of distribution, so within our food pantries, where we know the population is not going to see their primary care provider. Maybe they have an untreated, maybe they have high blood pressure and they just don't know it. We actually see that quite frequently. So all of these pieces really come together to help us serve in a way in this connector role to build our network and to focus our efforts around how do we improve the health and well-being of our region's grandmothers, mothers, fathers, children through a comprehensive approach.
And I'll say that some of the things Paul and I have talked about, and I'll just kind of put it to the panel, and then we'll definitely save plenty of time for questions because I know we have them. For example, like that blood pressure screening program, mm-hmm. that's something done kind of in conjunction with the American Heart Association. You know, Paul and I have talked very honestly about the fact that, so let's say you do screen someone positive, like, okay, what then? You know, we certainly know that you've got in-house dietitians who have obviously great skills, better than even what I and our medical training and Matt and our medical training have done, but that's maybe not enough. You know, they may need a medical intervention. So part of what, like, Paul and I are constantly, like, struggling with is, okay, so then what's the natural conduit? And one kind of success factor we found is, can people like me or Matt at least serve as almost, like, informational resources mm-hmm. for the food pantry coordinators who have the trust and the buy-in from the community member but, you know, don't necessarily want to go to a strange doctor. And I got to tell you, healthcare really, you know, the way we set up our institutions, it's hard. I mean, parking and trying to come to our clinics, and even when they're embedded inside of housing, mm-hmm. it's you have to take time off work because mm-hmm. clinics are only open in the daytime. And so we're trying to struggle with how do we make this accessible? And it's Matt said it right. It's like meet people where they are. But unfortunately, a lot of what we set up ourselves for we don't necessarily do that. So how do we break through those conventions to meet people where they are? And, you know, we're trying to constantly think of creative ways to do that. So, Adrian, let me come back to you. You touched on, you know, we're in a time of fiscal constraint. I mean, I'm sure you're having to go back to a pile of in-mail with how you're dealing with your next budget cycle, sure. how you're sure. dealing with this. Can you, I wanted to pivot this a little bit to almost, if you had your wish list, you know, what are some things you wish you could see, either better public-private sector collaboration, resource allocation, thinking about state budgets? What is it that we could do better?
I think that, and Stuart said this well earlier, I think there's not a lot of thought about cost savings when we go outside of our silos. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, it will cost any large urban city roughly between $50,000 to $80,000 a year to shelter a homeless family. It costs me roughly $15,000 a year to house a family. And we keep, as housers, we keep saying that number over and over again, but we hit a brick wall. particularly when it comes to the funders at the federal level, in terms of saying, look, there is a value to housing that is not just about creating affordable housing. There are the other impacts to the rest of the networks that touch a family where we will save funds. And there hasn't been, I think, if I had a wish list, mm-hmm. I think the number one thing would be we have done this great calculation in terms of how to make a more efficient process of moving a family from a homeless shelter into a unit and what the cost benefits mm-hmm. are. But we haven't really done that as well in other parts that are costing us lots of money as a community, whether it be healthcare, whether it be a poor education system. We've not seen that kind of thought process that shows if we just do a little bit here, the bang for our buck 10, 15, 20 years from now for the child is going to save us all a whole lot of money at the end of the day. I think that that's a heavy lift. It's sometimes hard because I know if I approach the local hospitals, I say, why don't you just give me some of your money?
Now. Maybe it'll make
trust me, and you will save money in the back end. It doesn't go over very smoothly. So I think that it'd be great to have
we need evidence, right?
We need evidence, but we need people to buy into the fact that because it's a zero-sum game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Something has to be taken away and given to another system. And that is a hard, even if we find the evidence, the question is, will there be a political or even just a will in general to do that? Affordable housing is expensive at the front end, but the long-term benefits for a community are just priceless. And I don't think that we think about it that way. We always think about affordable housing as being for somebody else versus what the community impact would be.
That's a great... Matt, what could... If you had to think about, you know, you're working on transitions, you mentioned kind of videos or, you know, telephone calls, what's on your wish list for some things that we wish we could, you know, that we know we could do better, kind of, for example, in our hospital setting or in that transitional setting?
I think, again, just having things in place to catch people. I really liked Stuart talking about the district nurse. I feel like there's mm-hmm. enough with
the analogy of that.
Maybe not the 88-year-old I'm sending home that would work. I mean, it would in an actual person, but I'm thinking some sort of an online platform. Like, I live in a townhome community, and there's a Facebook group. Like, mm-hmm. if we could have a district nurse.
Facebook. But is that, do you find that there's a problem with people's accessibility to media online, or have you found that actually pretty much people are connected in some way?
I don't have a firm answer. More are connected than not, as they get older, they're not. And mm-hmm. I'm sort of jaded, and that's the population I work with the most. But that's getting better and better. And I think of all the boomers that are going to need care and how connected they'll be and the potential that there is for online solutions and online communities, frankly, to help with that. And then I think having a sort of like a massive list of all the services, and I know like Iona's resource, community resource book is incredible, but having like an online thing where if you're in the city and you need help with X, Y, or Z, you can just type that in and find out what would work for you, what's affordable for you, and what sort of options are out there that maybe somebody could be picking up groceries for you once mm-hmm. a week, and you don't have to, you know, go hungry or have health problems associated with that.
Right. Paula, I'm hoping you're going to say this, so if you're not, I'm going to hint to this. You always teach me something, but we talked about kind of your food pantries. I want you to also continue with the theme of a wish list before we get to questions. Mm-hmm. So think about some of your wish lists, but hopefully tucked in there somewhere is what you told me about how you actually need help getting the food to people, because you can have all these kind of 44 community-based organizations, but you're still finding that one of the greatest challenges is almost the, you know, getting the food from the pantry into people's homes. So tell me about your wish list in a very practical way, and also that problem that you're seeing of getting the food out.
Right. I think my wish list focuses most on how do we create access to good food in every community and for every type of person. And so building on our existing work, it would be to create continuity between these anchor institutions in our community so that we're reinforcing the same messages, so that folks know how to best utilize their dollars, so that we're building access points where they're needed, and that we really have a sense of the need and that we're addressing it appropriately. And that involves a whole lot of of shifts and commitments from organizations of all different types, for-profits, nonprofits, government institutions. And so I think we're seeing those shifts happen incrementally, but to have a community-focused and community-based approach that leads to successful outcomes is my biggest wish. And in terms of sort of the, you know, part of our what we employ at the food bank, actually, we do have some sophisticated tools, one of which is a hunger heat map that shows the gaps in our services. So it assesses the food that we're putting in the community against the need to show gaps. And that gap analysis is really critical. And what we're finding as we're scaling, as food banks are scaling, is that we just have to invest in this last mile work with reaching folks who are homebound, who are disabled, for some other reason maybe lack sufficient transportation to the grocery store, to the neighborhood pantry. Again, I like to stress, you think about this robust network of 444 organizations, and certainly we have some really key partners who have a lot of capacity, but most of these are, you know, pantries that are open twice a month. So if you can't make it on those twice a month, then you are challenged. So it's about, you know, just making connections, really thinking about capacity and thinking about how maybe hospitals can build the capacity of the emergency food safety net rather than maybe reinventing it within the own organization.
A very real example of this is that our hospital, you know, one thing in the Affordable Care Act has been for nonprofit hospitals to maintain their nonprofit status, to kind of do community health needs assessments. And part of those dollars have to be driven towards actually the community. It's been a great, you know, we can call it a carrot stick, I don't care, but it's been a great tool to have a conversation and a practical ongoing example. There's mobile vans that are being deployed around the district. I'm trying to figure out how we can actually take these mobile clinic ideas and actually have part of that serve as almost kind of a food delivery service as well. So
that's a big fan of Capillary Food Bank. I mean, we do our job to try to get food from your part of the world
exactly.
into our 8,000
into the homes.
Into our homes.
And a lot of our partners are actually nonprofit housing providers.
Exactly.
Right. And which makes so much sense because that's a great example of literally meeting people where they are. Questions so that we can start to get the, I know this gentleman had his hand up in the last session, so maybe back here. Before we get to your question, I'm going to close by being slightly controversial with my wish list. One, I really do wish that we had a very hard time. We saw in the state of New York kind of the use of Medicaid dollars for housing vouchers, and there have been some very interesting studies, well-validated scientific research that demonstrated kind of the benefits of that use. But certainly that's been riddled with controversy around, is that the appropriate use of Medicaid, state budget dollars? I would absolutely, and I know I'm setting this up hopefully for Stuart's like last panel, which is kind of bringing it home, but my wish list is that we do a better job teaching not just our feds, my friends that are all working to try to make this country a better place, but just how feds can work with state and local governments to think about these creative, kind of, Stuart mentioned this ability for states to be flexible, how we allow for that room for flexibility, but that we don't burden, in doing so, that we don't overregulate it to the point where it crumbles from the weight of all the caveats and regulations, and you can't do this, and you must do this. Because in some ways, I actually think that's where New York kind of faltered, because there were so many people worried that, oh my God, we're going to let these people get housing vouchers, and what's going to happen? And it really kind of crumbled under its own weight in some regards. And it was criticized, but I think it was a brave initiative, and I think that the ongoing need to be creative at that level is going to be, whether no matter what party affiliation you are, it has to be done in a flexible way. So how can we as policymakers mitigate unintended consequences and hold ourselves accountable without kind of overburdening and inhibiting that potential for communities to design truly flexible approaches to whether it's the Medicaid program with dollars associated with that, whether it's dedicated housing dollars, whether it's SNAP or WIC resources. I would include all kind of government or public-based sources in that. And then I know this is a conversation I've had with colleagues from foundations, and you're going to meet Dr. Graham, and I know he believes this. how do we push philanthropic organizations to think about sustainable economic models for what we're doing? So all of us are, I mean, there was a point where I was like an addict to grant writing and, you know, everything could be done through philanthropic organizations. We have got to turn that into building it into part of our economic model. So in medicine, we talk about a PMPM, a per member per month. How do I get a PM, a portion of that, what I'm used to calling a PMPM, to be a part of buying membership for the villages, to be a part of actually giving Paula some of that money and letting her use that for neighborhood dedicated, you know, for her organizations, for what Adrian's doing. And so I would say those are at least two of my wishes. So I'll stop there. And the gentleman back there had a question, and then we'll just open it up to general questions.
Herbros, fiscal concerns have been discussed here at length. Since we have the executive director of the District of Columbia Housing Agency here, based on an article appearing in yesterday's Washington Post, I'm wondering why the District of Columbia had to pay back the federal government a grant of over $15 million since they missed a date for filing that was required.
Right. So just for clarity, so I'm the District of Columbia Housing Authority. Unfortunately, the entity that had to turn the money back is the District of Columbia Housing and Community Development Agency, which is the city's housing department, not the ones charged with public housing. I mean, I can't speak to that as I'm not charged with those funds, but I will say that clearly nobody wants to see
money
go back. I think that if there's any solace, the good thing is that money, well, it may have not been used here in D.C., would be repurposed and sent to other cities. So from a national community standpoint, that's one point of view. But I can't speak to it because it was not my agency, sir.
Another question? I thought I saw a hand over here. Yes, ma'am, back there.
In the past two panels, all of the speakers have spoke to urban communities. What is being done in rural communities, especially as our rural communities age, to help build healthy communities in rural areas?
I'm glad you brought that up. We have been focusing, obviously, on D.C. in this panel, an urban area. But does anybody want to? I can speak to that. Paula, do you want to speak to that?
So we serve DC and then all the way into Prince William County, Virginia. So we definitely have a big urban center. We have suburban areas, and we have some areas that we're reaching that are rural. So it's really interesting to think about. And you know, one of the ways that we've thought about serving rural areas differently is we look at where rural pockets of poverty and food insecurity exist. And the first thing we do is, of course, we say, like, we look at the data, and then we say, what is happening on the ground? So one of those kind of findings that we saw was that along the Route 1 corridor in Virginia, there was a lot of childhood food insecurity. And there were a real lack of organizations that were addressing it in a concerted way. And so this is a great example of our grocery partners. We actually had a conversation with one of our grocery partners, Shoppers Food Warehouse, and said, you know, they're entrenched in Virginia. And we said, hey, this is something we'd like to take on. Will you fund it? And they actually helped us construct a mobile meals bus that goes down the Route 1 corridor and provides summer meals in trailer homes and other places that are disconnected. I know we talked a lot about little being bifurcated by highways. That exists in the service area that we touch. So it's about, you know, knowing the community and then building and being flexible enough to build a targeted approach for that community and investing in it.
And I'll say from a healthcare standpoint, one thing that that I and some of our colleagues participate in is a program called Project Echo. And it actually provides, we find that in rural areas, there's always some, like, either a one-person doctor's office, which is often the case, or maybe a rural health clinic, maybe sometimes even a critical access hospital that's designated for a rural area, but they lack certain specialty care, and they often then have the challenge, if someone has a diagnosis of cancer or something that requires specialists, that they have to tell patients they need to travel sometimes hundreds of miles to get that care. We're part, if you Google it, Project Echo, it's actually part of a very simple kind of training program that's done over video teleconference for 1 hour a week, where we actually have people teaching other clinicians in both rural and in urban areas where there's actually like deserts of these providers, how to take care of patients that might require more specialty-based care, but for which you just don't have it because you're in a rural setting or you're in an isolated setting. And so there's a great number of these issues that translate both urban and rural opportunities. There was a question over here. Yes, ma'am, back there.
Thank you all very much for the information you've given to us today. I have a question. I haven't heard anyone speak about the need for housing for trafficked children. As you might be aware, Congress reported in 2013 that over 300,000 American-born children are being trafficked in our country. Washington, D.C. is considered by certain reports to be the second city with the highest incidence of human trafficking. Why aren't we doing something about this in terms of housing? There are only two organizations, Fair Girls and, another one, who provide services in D.C. to help house these children. Many of the reasons why these children do not come forward to the local police is because they have nowhere to go. Please, can someone address this? Thank you so much.
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that I know that D.C. Does believe in is trying to find affordable housing solutions for the different populations that need it. In this particular space, there are nonprofit groups that we do work with, some of which I won't name because of for obvious reasons, but one that I will is Sasha Bruce. Some of you may be familiar with Sasha Bruce's work, and they have become a very safe place and a safe haven that even by word of mouth, a lot of our youth that feel challenged about entering the government sector, they're able to go, and it's a safe place for them. And there are other organizations like Sasha. We have a strong relationship with Sasha. I know other of my my government partners do as well. There's always more that can be done. Let me suggest that. I think that we just need to find a way that individuals feel that they can enter someplace and not be judged and be safe. And sometimes that's half the challenge, particularly if it's in a government space.
All right, I'm going to do the last question, and we're going to have a break. So if people who couldn't get a question in want to approach our panelists, we can. This lady in the back.
Yes, thank you. Paula, I know you had a principal role in improving the food that's available in D.C. schools. I'm wondering what the situation, I've just come here from the U.K., where I was struggling to make them appreciate that food in the NHS, make them appreciate that food is medicine. I found it very ironic that the patients who were there were being fed things that were not necessarily conducive to their recovery. So what's going on here with food in hospitals? Are you facing a similar situation to what you found in the schools?
Absolutely.
Oh, I'm not joking about it. I mean, I know that we did a kind of a canvas of the district area hospitals and found that all the hospitals, the major hospitals in the district, and I don't think this is too dissimilar from other urban and rural, we basically vend out our food resources to a third party,
right,
with which we have very little, like zero kind of, you know, dialogue about nutritional input or output.
And I will say we haven't necessarily been involved in that, but from my personal experience, what I found is actually the same third-party food vendors that are serving hospitals are also serving schools, and
right,
they're also serving businesses, prisons. They're across the board. They have different names for their different sort of segments of their business. But it's really important to, you know, have conversations with hospital administrators around how can we contribute to health within the hospital itself? And certainly, you know, I've actually been to meetings at hospitals where I've forgotten to have breakfast and literally all they have is donuts. So these are ongoing challenges. I know within the district there's a committee that's under the Department of Health called the Diabesity Committee. that is contains a group of clinicians and folks who are associated with hospitals who are trying to make inroads on that front and also around sugar-sweetened beverages and the proliferation of sugar and allowance of sugar-sweetened beverages in hospitals. So there's work being done.
I think, if I can say something, that we have not for our patients but for our staff. Like, as of June 1st, if you visit the Sibley Hospital, you're not going to be able to get French fries. Like, they're getting rid of, right. Like, it's a wholesale nutrition
But that
increase.
Was done, I know, speak to, that took effort to
yeah,
educate.
Yeah, and that's a Hopkins, my understanding is that's a Hopkins system-wide
right.
thing,
right.
And it's been, it's going to be interesting to see how that goes.
And people get angry,
over.
By the
oh,
way.
Yeah.
I mean, people,
take their French
people
fries? Come on.
Are not, you know, me being one of them sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people sometimes get upset yeah. about choices being taken away.
Right.
But it's to speaking to that lady's question yeah. about, you know, how are we offering something that's healthier? So, Joe, I know there's more questions. We're going to have a little bit of a break just to stretch bathroom and then get into our final panel. Join me in thanking, I think, this excellent panel. I ran a little bit over, but let's try to be back in the next 5 to 7 minutes if possible. But bathrooms are immediately out the doors, kind of straight across this room. Past the right past the donuts. We're not a hospital, so I don't know what you expect.
You know what's frustrating though? It's like I go back to Sibley and go back to like it's like my.
Well, to be honest, our policies General idea. Do I have 1 minute to run to the bathroom?
Yes, yes, just over there.
Okay, I'll be right back.
Five more conversations.
Yeah, so. About to begin, so if you could please retake your seats and get comfortable, we will start the final panel. And as you're doing that, I just want to alert you. You'll see up here a Twitter site, a Twitter handle, Healthy Communities. I'm told there's a lively conversation going on. Kavita is completely unaware of that because she's still talking about the Facebook. You can go onto the Twitter and you can see this conversation. And please continue this afterwards so we can add some things to it, alert people if you know what's going on. I'm going to try to channel Kavita, who, as you can see, has an effortless way of interacting with with panelists and getting the conversation going. So I'm going to attempt to do that. Our task is very simple. In this last panel, we're going to solve all the problems that have just been discussed and say what policy steps are needed to deal with all of that. I would just sort of mention to you, just urge you to look at some of the publications that we've done in this area on the Brookings site. We actually have a publication that will be coming out in the next maybe 2 or 3 weeks, actually looking at nurses as intermediaries within the system, I'm told. Wendy informed me a few minutes ago that this is actually National Nurses Week. And so we will be doing something on nurses. We've also got a publication that looks at hospitals and at schools as hubs. If you go onto the website, the Brookings website, and search for me or any of the others that have written in this area, you'll see a little superscript that says Building Healthy Neighborhoods. And if you click on that, you'll see all the publications that we've done in that area. It's also been mentioned that we hold a roughly monthly brainstorming session here with people from different sectors, and Adrian Todden comes to that quite often, and so does Wendy on this panel. And this is where we start to kind of really digest the kind of conversations we're having here, think about these different issues, and try to come up with a set of policy steps that would really make these kinds of collaborations more effective. And that's actually supported by the Robert Johnson Foundation. And as you may know, that Robert Johnson Foundation has a whole theme called looking at the culture of health. How do we get both
behavior patterns and other institutions to work together to create health. So it's all very connected in this way. So as I said, we're going to try to look at some of the issues that have come up in the previous panels and sort of explore some of the policy implications of this and how we could think about improving connectedness and steps in this way. And we've got two very effective and great panelists to help me in this. And let me start with actually with Dr. Garth Graham on my far right here. And Garth really straddles a number of areas, which I think is one of the reasons why it's going to be particularly good to hear his insights. He's is the president of the Aetna Foundation, and so therefore is focused on its philanthropic work. But also he's written and thought a lot about health disparities, the kind that Dana brought up in the previous panels. He served in government, God bless him, as Deputy Assistant Secretary in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and has also been in the academic world as Assistant Dean for Health Policy and Chief of Health Services Research at the University of Florida School of Medicine. Wendy Ellis, who is a stalwart member of our monthly group, is a project director at Building Community Resilience Collaborative at the Millikan Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University here in D.C., and I'll let her talk a little bit more about this in a moment. But the collaborative develops strategies for child health systems to address determinants that lead to toxic stress and the kinds of problems that we know develop from that. Wendy's also been involved in the hospital system as manager of children health policy at the National Office of the Nemours Children Health System. So we've all had some connection in some way with both the policy side, with the academic research, and with what's going on. Maybe, Wendy, I can actually start with you. And maybe say a little bit more about the work that you're doing across the country in different neighborhoods, because you're not just looking at D.C. and research in at the national level, but actually what's been going on in some places. We've talked about some of those at our monthly meetings. I wonder if you could just give us just a couple of minutes on the kinds of things that are going on in these communities where you're fostering collaboration, and what gets in the way, and what could be done in terms of the policy environment to just make your life and the life of those communities a little bit easier?
Sure. Easy question there. So the Building Community Resilience Collaborative is actually based on the research I have been doing, just trying to understand, you know, coming from a hospital's perspective, we have so much research that really speaks to the longitudinal health impacts of children being exposed and being raised in very adverse community environments. So understanding that we have this whole body of research called ACEs that talk about adverse childhood experiences. So understanding that a child that's raised in abusive or neglectful environments where they have a parent perhaps that's been incarcerated or subjected to community violence, that these things actually get under the skin. So understanding that that's one piece of it, and many of you have the handout that was out front there, but there's also this other piece, understanding that those experiences that are happening within the household are compounded often by what's happening in their environments, their community environments. So we've actually started talking about the pair of ACEs, not just what's happening to the individual, but what's happening to that individual within the context of their communities. So understanding that if you have communities, and we've talked about on these panels this morning, a number of those different adversities, whether that's community disruption that's brought on by gentrification, that then leads to housing instability for families, understanding that food insecurity in itself is an adversity, but it also could be consistent with a community environment that is cut off by, say, a food desert, as Danya described earlier this morning. So looking at those things, as a child health system, you can't write a prescription for all these things that occur in the community. But yet you have a role to play. So I designed a process by which communities, child health systems, and other anchor institutions could potentially come together to collaborate. Sounds easy, right? Not so much. So what we found is that so we're testing this model here in Washington, D.C., and Cincinnati, Ohio, Wilmington, Delaware, Dallas, Texas, and Portland, Oregon. And what we're finding that while it sounds good in theory that all sectors should come together, it is very hard to do. There are some things that are built into our systems that actually discourage collaboration. Some things in our financing structures that actually discourage collaboration. So we just did, in fact, we were in Portland, Oregon last week, doing a collaborative meeting with a couple of child health systems, with Oregon Health Authority, with the Oregon Public Health Institute, a lot of state level as well as local level agencies, as well as nonprofits that are very much interested in addressing these adversities that are facing children as well as their families and communities at large. The process of identifying the priorities, so we take them through this process of let's identify what are the pair of bases that are the priorities in Oregon or in Portland. So obviously the opioid crisis and the resultant effects of that. So looking at, you know, the burdens on the foster care system when children are pushed out of homes because their parents are somehow either adjudicated or, worst case, when the parents have overdosed. So you've got that issue. That's one piece. But then you've got homeless children. You know, we did a graphic that showed, and what we found is that visualizing the problem is a lot easier to really help people understand the impact, the widespread impact. So we did a visual chart that showed 182,000 children in Oregon are homeless. That's a number. What's the denominator? Okay, 182,000 children that are homeless. What we ended up doing is creating a chart that showed that across the state of Oregon, there's 7 really popular sports stadiums. The number of homeless children would fill 7 of those sports stadiums. And it was actually more than, so you'd have standing only capacity. That number meant something to the mm-hmm. to folks there. We similarly did a convening in Cincinnati 2 weeks ago, and we showed that the number of children that were at risk would fill school buses 7 miles long. So from University of Cincinnati across the river into Kentucky, that's the number of homeless children, the number of vulnerable children in that community. So understanding that these are just children that we're talking about. These children are part of a larger unit, the family. So how do you begin to bring together the systems, the infrastructure that impacts all of these points of care or points of service for these families? That's the difficult part. Because we were able to identify the priorities in Oregon, but then when the question came, so now how will we work together? The room went silent. Because while you had those that were very passionate and interested in collaborating, then you have to think about, well, is the right person at the table to make that decision? Can I speak on behalf of my agency? Or if I drive forward, what's going to be the implication for my revenue stream, my funding stream? You know, how is the state going to look upon this collaboration? So without having some sort of okay from a higher level, meaning, you know, the funders or the revenue streams or those other stakeholders, it's very difficult to bring individuals to collaboration.
I can imagine. And we'll try to talk a little bit about how do we create the environment. But, I mean, I think from what you said, it sounds like, you know, it's very important to have an organization there that's got some capacity and has the trust of the mm-hmm. people around it. They're familiar with it. And I think that's one of the reasons we've looked at things like schools as being really could be very important in that regard. I wonder whether you think there are other institutions, and also what are the institutions which are difficult to get to the table? I know some people will talk about hospitals in a moment too, but I think some people have an ambivalent relationship with a GW or some other hospital. They may think, yes, it's got the capacity and so on, but what's its objectives in life? You know, does it really fit with us? How do you build trust in someone? And I think that clearly kind of one of the issues, is it not?
Well, and so I think other, you know, understanding that there is difficulty for hospitals to kind of push forward in this work, because typically, you know, if they're going to do work in community, they've led the charge.
Right.
And that stepped on a lot of toes. And so that's why strategically I started with hospitals, because you have a lot of work. Historically, we've had a lot of work going on in communities, really great work in communities. Then you've had on the other side of this bridge, you have folks that are doing really good work in hospitals that will identify priorities in communities, and they have to lead the charge. So it was really trying to change the mentality of our clinicians, our providers in the hospitals, to think instead of pre-identifying based upon your health needs assessment or your utilization data, what are the priorities of communities, sit back, let's listen and let's work together. So it's helping. What we really look at is, you know, doing a process of education with our providers and our hospitals that are involved to really be in that place of humility, mm-hmm. and being willing to listen and then co-create the solutions, okay. together. So that's really been the process of change within the BCR communities, as opposed to, you know, have it, because hospitals are really good at that. They're very good at looking at their own data. But it's the part of, you know, just going in, and what we say in our BCR meetings is, mm-hmm. for physicians, is take off the white coat and let's just be a citizen. Let's, mm-hmm. yeah.
Let me bring Garth in a couple of ways, really. One is, of course, that, you know, one of the people who pay the bills are insurers in the healthcare system. And I think probably most people would feel that insurers have not been in the lead in trying to figure out how to get smart healthcare in the community, as opposed to paying bills when you go to the hospital and so on. I'd like to hear you sort of comment a little bit on what your experience has been in that area, and how you think insurers are, in fact, moving forward in this way, and what the possibility is. The other thing I just want to ask you to raise another related issue is, when we start thinking about government policy in this area, and what can the government do to help? Which level of government do you really feel has both the best level of capacity and so on? What are some of the issues with, sure. that?
So I guess one of the things we've been talking about here all day is that all health is really local. And when you look at it, we've often used the term that your zip code is more important than your genetic code, and it's real. And if you look at the data that was just published yesterday by Chris Murray and his group out on the West Coast, they showed an increasing gap in terms of a 20-year life expectancy gap across counties, from the poorest counties up into the richest counties in Colorado. And I have some very pivotal piece of information that's been repeated in other studies looking across the board. When you think about how we've kind of addressed this, and you alluded to this earlier, we, you know, in general, as a healthcare system overall, have spent most of our money, 60% of our resources have gone towards clinical care in the United States, as opposed to 40% to social services. And in a lot of other countries, it's the opposite, where, right. Especially Absolutely. In Europe and other places, where they spend more on social services as opposed to clinical care. I'll tell you that I come at this from a very personal level. You mentioned kind of my background in terms of academics and government before, but I'll also tell you that I've kind of lived this. And when we first came to this country, I was living in Opa-locka, Florida. And I suffered an asthma attack from the mold that was in the building that we were living in. And my sister also had an asthma attack as well. And the fear that was on my mother's eyes as we were kind of going through this has always kind of kept me motivated through the years in terms of how we approach this work, the organizations that I work for, and some of the strategies that we employ. So I'll tell you, you asked about how do we think about this from a kind of insurer payment perspective. So I think at Aetna, we have a very consumer-centric view, and we believe in addressing that 60% as well. And so through Medicaid, a lot of activity occurring in our Medicaid programs, we're utilizing community health workers as well as other kinds of means to address both the social, economic, housing, transportation, as well as employment opportunities in a number of places across the country. One of the folks asked about rural areas, and we're doing some amazing work with community health workers in McDowell County in West Virginia, and reaching some of those very isolated individuals in West Virginia. We also, on the Aetna broader insurer side, in Medicare Advantage, have done about 330 home health assessments just in 2016. That's where doctors and nurses go in and assess, you know, the home environment of that particular patient or that particular individual, and help to identify some of those challenges. And overall, we've done about 500,000 home visits overall, working with doctors and nurses. That's on that broader side. But I want to go back to one point and talk about how we work with communities, because that's particularly important. Because this idea of using communities as a vehicle to effectuate change is part of the strategy. The example I gave you about me and my sister had that asthma attack when we were younger, it was one of those local community organizations that kind of mobilized my family out of fear in a very acute moment. So that's why it's important to us. So we work with a number of communities across the country to be able to mobilize change. For instance, there is the Living Healthy Community Collaborative that's in Athens, Ohio, where they have a 29% obesity rate, as well as one of the lowest access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And we worked with them to increase the access to fruits and vegetables by 93% within that local community. We talked about the delivery of fresh fruits and vegetables over the past last year, working with key communities in Cleveland, in Ohio, in Texas, and in Florida, delivered about 1.1 million pounds of food and built about 5,500 extra resources in terms of additional plots of land developed for fresh fruit. And that's part of kind of how we think through all of these varied approaches. But I talked about Chris Murray's work and looking at kind of understanding county-level dynamics. And we, as well as a number of other foundations, have really like, kind of looked at how we work with cities and counties as particular units. And through this initiative that we have called the Healthy Cities and Counties Initiative, we've been working with 50 cities and counties from small to medium-sized cities and counties across the country to help identify tackling some of these social determinants of health and giving them a framework in which to work with, looking at five issues, not just healthy behaviors as one issue, but also crime and community safety, looking at the built environment, looking at environmental exposure, as well as looking at some of those socioeconomic characteristics that we've been alluding to today. And here's where I kind of want to emphasize what we're seeing on the ground, because sometimes in D.C., we feel that everything that needs to happen is happening here.
There is that tendency.
There is that tendency, especially if you turn on the television. I believe the opposite. I believe there's a lot of activities that are occurring locally and elsewhere that are quite frankly moving the needle, and this is part of the communities that we're working with. So, for instance, someone asked a little bit about what's occurring in housing. As part of this Healthy Cities and Counties initiative that we've been working on, we've seen folks in York, Pennsylvania, for instance, pull together a healthy housing collaborative where they're combining both environmental exposure to asthma triggers, as well as other environmental activities, and looking at how do you use housing to address health. And so that's what's amazing to us when we saw that kind of work. We've also seen where in San Diego, where they've been doing a lot of work around social determinants of health, they've been doing walk and knock programs to pull together individuals in high crime communities with local police officers and other community safety strategies to bring together communities to deal with high crime neighborhoods. And so we have to understand that there are evolving things occurring outside of D.C. that are particularly important. And our goal is to support those communities, have them learn from each other, and uplift their kind of work so that people can learn across the board to see where things are going. So I think to answer your question in a nutshell, certainly I think there are a lot of activities we're doing from the business side and certainly in terms of how we invest and work with communities. But it's important for us to understand that all health is local, much like Tip O'Neill said back in the day, but also understanding that a lot of these communities, they have very strong people who are doing very real work, and it's about working with them to help find them solutions as one of the strategies.
I think, yeah.
Do you mind if I ask a question?
Please. Sure.
Because you talk a lot about, I'm going off script here. So, you talk about, and I find it fascinating, certainly worthwhile, the work that you're talking about doing in community. But one of the things that was brought up earlier by Adrian was this, and it's tossed around so often, and we talk about it in our groups about the wrong pocket problem. So, Adrian spoke of the fact that, if we were only to invest more in housing, we would save in healthcare. Yet for a hospital, when they hear that, that means decrease in revenue. So how, as an insurer, are you able, or are there some strategies that are being tested around incentivizing hospitals to do more community-based health care, more prevention-based health care that doesn't necessarily drive revenue into the hospital, but certainly would have some money in the pocket to offset the chronic care as versus prevention
care? Sure. In fact, with Medicaid, we're working in Mayville, Arizona, and actually helped to revitalize some housing complexes to allow people to have access to housing. So I think the concept of housing, even within our Medicaid population, has been are particularly important. You see some really interesting things occurring across the board in terms of hospitals. And I know we're going to probably talk a little bit more in terms of hospitals and community benefit. You've seen where there are certain hospitals, you've seen like Rush in Chicago and other places where They're actually been working to address a lot of the community health needs. And so in terms of not being too prescriptive to a particular hospital in terms of telling them what the community needs are, it might be housing in one location, it might be community safety in another location, it might be some different kinds of environmental exposure. One of the best strategies when you work with partners, whether it be hospitals, big health system, local nonprofit, is not to be prescriptive in what you think the problem is, but to go to them and to try to work with them to help uplift what they think are some of the challenges that they're working with in terms of communities. And so we've seen that hospitals have identified, as well as other community partners, have identified a varied spectrum of potential challenges. But again, all of these challenges are particularly local.
Yeah, let me kind of pick up on that a little bit for a moment. I think when you mentioned, I think, the so-called wrong pocket problem, and if for those of you who are not familiar with that term, it really means that we're talking about a situation where in order to get a real benefit over here, you actually have to invest in a totally different sector. And why should, and so the people who carry the cost don't actually get the benefit in some way. And how do you make this work? And hospitals are a classic example of this for the reasons you mentioned. That if the hospital, was it Kavita said, the CF no is approached and basically is told, you know, we can invest in all this to deal with homeless people and deal with all this issue and go to Adrian and invest in the housing, and it will really reduce the number of people who need our services. You know, you don't have to be a CF no to be able to say, wait a minute, I don't see how we can sustain that model if we're the ones carrying the costs and there's no benefit. And so therefore it forces those who think about this to think, how can you look at ways in which you can kind of go up a level in a sense almost to say, how can we look at the whole picture in some way? And there are certainly some interesting examples of that. I mean, you're very familiar, I'm sure, with Geisinger in central Pennsylvania, which is a combination of an insurer that actually owns hospitals, has contracts with physicians, and so on, can look at the whole picture and say, well, it actually makes sense to invest in these physicians over here or in these non-medical areas, because it will reduce our costs in the hospital base, and therefore, as an insurer, we're going to be able to compete more effectively and keep our costs down. And I think when we start looking at government's role, we have the same kind of analog. How can we look at these different sectors and get them to kind of work together in one way? Well, and to get that to happen all the way down the system, right down to where it really matters at the bottom level. I think we look at things like the waiver systems. I mean, we've got, and demonstrations. We use waivers in Medicaid and in other programs to say, okay, if you can do something a little different there, we'll keep an eye on it, but we'll give you permission to do that for a period, and then we'll study and see if it actually works, and that might then affect the rules generally. I think it's telling that I think both of you have brought up Medicaid, Medicare Advantage, and so on, and certainly in the Medicaid managed care area, you are talking about cases there where a whole group of the population is enrolled in a plan of some kind, a Medicaid managed care plan or a Medicare Advantage plan. And that plan as a whole has a strong incentive to look at how to keep its costs down and is more likely to experiment. And I think, you know, in order to make that happen, the federal government has to do more of what it's doing of looking at the rules and regulations with the payment systems, what can be covered, and this sort of thing, to make it a little easier for experimentation to occur. So I think we've got at least some idea of how to move forward in that area. I think another issue I wanted to bring up is, which I haven't really dwelled on yet, is the whole issue of data, of information. Again, we keep hearing this more and more in our conversations, that if you're going to figure out how to be more cost-effective and with better outcomes of involving different sectors and community institutions, you've got to, first of all, know what's going on in those places and also be able to make the case to use data to demonstrate that it might be better to use money differently. One of the things I've learned about in Washington is that people who control budgets in different agencies, they think it's like their money, sort of belongs to them, and they're very hesitant about letting that money go to somebody else. It's pretty understandable, I suppose. So they've got to have pretty convincing information to make that possible. And that seems to me to be a big issue. How much does data, the lack of data, the difficulty of sharing data, how much of that is a problem
We know privacy issues sort of come up with this. People don't like to share their information. Think about things like mental health. Parents at school are very nervous about letting information about their child's behavioral problems at school be shared around too much, because who knows how that may come back to haunt that child when he tries to go get a job 10 years later or something like that. How does data affect kind of what both of you are doing, and what are the problems there?
So data is absolutely critical to understanding how effective we are in a collaborative environment. So being able to share that data across different agencies, whether those are the schools, the hospitals, you know, even the community-based organizations. And so that's actually been at the heart of the project that we've been working at. Well, and part of the reason why we actually built our own data collection platform so that we could provide a basis for those that are participating in the collaborative to be able to see each other's data, right, and understand how working together is actually contributing to addressing the population's needs. But when you talk about sharing data on an individual level, you know, we actually did a lot of work early on before we even developed our own dashboard, and talking to the Office of the National Coordinator and understanding what are some of the capabilities, what are the limitations, and actually what do you have cooking that might help us to incentivize sharing of data across sectors right now. And so, you know, one of the things that, and I think is a really good example, is their ELT, CMS and ONC together put together a ELTSS pilot that they're launching in 7 states. So it's electronic long-term services records, where they're allowing individuals to share their information across healthcare sectors, but also those community providers.
Yeah.
So you heard a lot about the villages, as we spoke earlier. Well, the villages could actually share data with the healthcare provider, with the patient has opted in, so that you're not just seeing what service you're providing, but the whole plethora of services that this individual might be receiving. So if you're at the food bank and you're looking at, I need to have food brought to Ms. Johnson, you're able to open up and see, but Ms. Johnson is also diabetic. So that's going to inform the type of choices that I'm making for this individual. Or you could see the types of medications that they're on and know that they're going to need an increased need for hydration, or mm-hmm. there might be something that contradicts with having citrus juices. So you can really make informed choices for individuals at the community level so that you are reducing that return into the hospital system. But, you know, when we get hospitals talking about sharing data, the lawyers, so you got the CFOs and then you got the lawyers that get involved. And
I'm shocked to hear that, the lawyers.
You know, and so, but one of the things that, you know, in our conversations with ONC was made very clear that patients always have the option to share their data. This isn't necessarily clearly communicated to patients.
I think that's a really important point, and it's good that you mentioned the Office of the National Coordinator at the federal level, in terms of trying to inform people how to use data. I mean, we hear a lot of the so-called HIPAA rules, the regulations that make it difficult to share medical data. There are equivalent so-called FERPA rules in the education area. You can't say too much about a student to anybody. So the school nurse is trying to figure out what's going on with this child, and it's very difficult to get that information.
We have examples of where HIPAA and FERPA actually work together.
That's
Delaware
right.
is a very good example where they're able to share records between the medical community and the school-based nurses, so that what's happening in the school clinic is being shared back to the provider.
And I think it's really, from the ONC down, I think one of the possible solutions to this is actually to provide a lot more both information about what you can do, to dispel a lot of often myths about what you can't do. People tend to be risk-averse, understandably, if they think lawyers are going to be involved especially. And maybe give some kind of safe harbor approaches to say, well, okay, if you basically operate in this way, you're going to be basically okay, to kind of go down the system in that way. I think that's certainly an area we've discussed a lot in our group in terms of how to just enable what can be done to enable people to be aware of that, so that it doesn't become a fear factor in just resisting these things.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, data, there's two levels of data when I think about this. So, for instance, in terms of some of the work we're doing here with COVID and some of the activities around D.C. So in D.C., you know, 10 zip codes generate, you know, 83% of the hospital discharges. So that kind of aggregate data and being able to target resources is particularly important. And so there is a utilization of data. Now, the HIPAA and the other protection standards on the federal education side allow for individual protection, but do allow for a lot of decent population analysis and being able to target some of what we're doing now. But I'll tell you, if you want to kind of, in terms of how I think about this, so I think there is the population level data, but I do think it's important to be able to assess individual patients and individual dynamics. Those 330,000 home health assessments that we do through Medicare Advantage, particularly important. And I'll give you a personal example. About 5 years ago, there was a patient that I would constantly take to the cath lab and, you know, open her up and, you know, constantly take, you know, assume that part of the challenge was that she was not being compliant with her medications. Then we were able to do a home visit and realize that the challenge was actually her navigating to get water to take her pills. Right. So it's a simple thing like that in terms of understanding some of the individual home dynamics. And that's why it's important, as I kind of alluded to earlier, to be able to get in and understand a lot of those home health dynamics as well, but being able to understand some of the population level data. And so I think they're both equally important in terms of being able to be impactful.
Let us, I'd like to move to questions from the audience or observations. Please try to keep them short. And this is the solutions panel. So we'd be really interested in sort of for your observations or questions about particular steps that could be made to solve some of the problems that we've talked about. There's a question over here first, and one at the back. And if you could just introduce yourself as well, quickly.
Hi, Andrew Olson from the Green and Healthy Homes Initiative. Do you think it would be useful to have a mechanism that let a health plan invest directly in preventive services? Just a really brief warm-up question for you.
Yeah, so I think there is a lot of investment now in preventative health services. I think the question many times in terms of when we take this to the next level is making sure that we have enough investments overall, certainly nationally in terms of preventive health services. Right now, by the way our healthcare system is structured, we end up paying a lot on the back end for, you know, once people are hospitalized and secondary prevention, even after they have their first acute MI or something along those lines. But I think generally we all believe that shifting more towards prevention is particularly important. That's where the concept of data comes in line, right? So you're able to kind of identify some of those areas that are the highest need and be able to invest appropriately. But remember what I articulated to you earlier in terms of what's understanding what preventative services mean. There are clinical preventative services. That's the USPTF and everything that goes along with this. And they're understanding what are the social needs of an individual community and how those social needs end up driving a lot of the clinical outcomes. And if you look in the data that Chris Murray just published yesterday and has been getting a lot of coverage, that data points to at least 60 to 70% of the need being in the social services arena as opposed to the raw clinical arena when we think of preventative services.
So what do you, how valuable do you think it would be if you had a mechanism that let you invest in that social area and count it towards your medical cap rates?
Yeah, so I think part of what we've kind of been talking about here are different strategies in terms of how one, certainly I gave the examples of how we invest in social services and some of the various things we're doing through community health workers. This is on the kind of Aetna side of activities and some of those things. So I think there are organizations like us and others that believe in that investment in social services. And so I think that mechanism exists. The question is how, as a broader healthcare system, do we start to move towards mobilizing more around a lot of these social determinants of health as well?
I think one of the things, just to add on to that quickly, that you used the word investment a couple of times. And I think there's a big difference between investing in the sense of putting a significant amount of capital into building up something as opposed to covering it in the sense of, okay, if you have this service or if you go get a social service or a housing voucher, for example, we'll pay that as paying a benefit in some way. And I wonder just, again, if I get you to put your philanthropy hat on, again, to think as a philanthropist, I think there's a lot of conversation about what is the role of philanthropy in helping to build up that initial investment, including in things like data.
Yeah.
And so on. I wonder whether that may be a particularly important piece in which philanthropy can help in all of this, in the investment stage, so that then as you putting your other hat on,
sure,
working for a company that's an insurer,
yeah,
can actually come in and have the basic investment there and say, okay, now how can we modify our payment systems, you know, our benefit structure and so on. So you can make, you being the person, you can make use of that investment so that we can all get better health and we as an insurer can lower costs.
Sure. So from the philanthropy perspective, I'll tell you that that is a broad onus in terms of the mission of philanthropy, not just in a corporate, but all a non-corporate philanthropy. I sit on the board of Grantmakers in Health, and that's basically all of the various grantmakers around healthcare in general. And that is part of one of our main challenges, is how to not only invest appropriately, but for a lot of these investments be self-sustaining.
Right.
And so if you look at even the projects that I outlined to you earlier in terms of a lot of these local community projects, the best thing to be able to do is to invest locally and may allow these folks to stand up their activities and then allow them to leverage various other mechanisms, whether it be local businesses or other local entities that are equally invested in outcome to produce long-term sustainability. And so I think part of the challenge and part of the strategy on the philanthropic side is how to invest in a way that creates community sustainability. And the real secret for that is to have the community buy in and to be able to leverage a lot of those local resources appropriately.
We have a question at the back, the lady, what the lady back to us, and then down here.
Hi, my name is Imani Marshall. I'm an Emerson National Hunger Fellow with the Congressional Hunger Center. And Wendy, you brought up the opioid epidemic and some of the work that's being done in Cincinnati to address that you've been looking at. And I think that kind of the messaging around addressing this issue has been really powerful in moving our conversation of substance abuse to from one about criminalization to one about treatment and healthcare. But one kind of gap that I've seen is there has been a long history of criminalizing drug use and sale, especially in communities of color. And so I was wondering if you could speak to work that you've seen through the BCR being done to address this and looking at the generational impacts, especially on toxic stress living in kind of over-criminalized communities. And then Garth, additionally, you talked about work being done in San Diego around community safety. And so I was wondering if you could speak to that initiative as well. Thank you.
So with regard to, I think, you know, you would be irresponsible to not recognize that our opioid crisis in this country has been received with quite a bit of sympathy, as opposed to how our crack epidemic was received 20, 30 years ago with not quite the sympathy, right? So that there in itself is really the tale of two responses here. But one of the things that I think is really telling about the opioid crisis as opposed to the crack epidemic is that you are seeing this so widespread across the country. You are seeing this really striking at the heart of the middle, of what was once a solid middle class. And so what we're seeing, particularly in Cincinnati, is a really great example of this overall loss of hope, desperation in our country. You know, there was a figure that came out, and I don't know if any of you saw in Washington Post, did a really great series last year about the crisis. And within the time that was released, we also have figures that show that white American women were dying at younger ages. So we're looking at our mortality rates for white women, which typically should be the healthiest and has been historically the healthiest group in our country. Actually, you're seeing the rates for their mortality drop. That's telling you something else is going on beyond just the opioid crisis. It really does speak to what is happening within our healthcare system, clearly, and our other systems that are points of care. So that is housing. That is thinking about public transportation. Do people even have access to jobs? So one of our sites we looked at, only 6% of the actual jobs that provide a living wage are accessible by public transit. While people, at the same time, the phenomenon of gentrification is going on. So people are getting pushed further and further out, which means their access to both stable employment, housing, all of the resources that they have depended upon have become less available to them. So what we're seeing is, in response to the opioid crisis, is this awakening. It actually is an opportunity for an awakening of how our other systems are failing. Not just, you know, we have an increased need for mental health and substance abuse, but why are people resorting to this? What is at the heart of our pain? What are we dulling ourselves from so greatly that we are seeing, you know, children discovering their parents overdosed? Mm-hmm. What do you think are going to be the outcomes for those kids 3, 2, 5 years from now? So you don't have to wait, and I think we had this earlier conversation about the longitudinal impacts and looking at the long rate of return. We can now see that if you have a child that has been affected by their parents' opioid addiction at 2 years old, do you think that kid's going to go to school ready to learn at 5? What do you think their third grade reading rate is going to be? So we can really collapse the window of impact, and that's really what has driven a lot of our systems to come to the table in our 5 cities, is that it's provided an opportunity for everyone to see where they have skin in the game and have a role in addressing the issues.
Gautha, do you want to
answer? Sure, yeah. So as part of this Healthy Cities and Counties initiative that we've been doing, we're working with a number of cities and counties to tackle local problems. And again, the idea here is that you have local, either city or nonprofits, who understand these neighborhoods and can do things effectively with our additional support. And so we've seen a number of kind of key things around this area of community violence. So in Kansas City, they're treating violence as a disease. So what do I mean when I say that? We'll talk a little bit here about prevention and how you treat early as opposed to treat after a hospitalization or after an illness. And so the idea here is how to use the CDC Aim for Peace initiative and treat and use de-escalation tactics and use going to communities where there is a high prevalence or a high burden of various kinds of, especially individual violence, and teach de-escalation tactics to a lot of younger communities, as well as all the folks across the spectrum that are higher risk. So identifying the higher risk individuals, like we would do in clinical medicine, and teach preventative approaches before reaching an outcome that is undesired. And that activity in Kansas City is particularly important, and that shows one community solution. The other that we're seeing in San Diego is a different strategy, and the other strategy there is how to bring together local law enforcement as well as local community members to go to individual homes and engage folks around some of these broader communications about how to make communities safer. And so the concept that we've kind of identified here, and if you kind of leave with any conclusion from my perspective, is that a lot of these challenges are local and the solutions are local as well. And though, again, as I said earlier, though we sit here in Washington, D.C., we have to understand that there is a body of work, an amazing body of work occurring in communities across the board, and it's about how we lift up some of that work, support some of that work, and allow people to learn from each other.
I think that's a good good comment in order to kind of wind up this panel, I think, and this meeting. I mean, that there's an enormous body of work going on. I think that we certainly here in Washington, or Washington Think Tank, recognize very much that both the ideas and the things on the ground that are happening are really important to look at and to understand and to get a sense of what's going on. And then what is the environment in which we can enable those efforts to blossom? And we've talked,
do you mind if I put a
you want the last word?
Okay, well, no. I think that, you know, it's great that we can sit here and be academic on this conversation, but there is a real absolute sense of urgency in our response here. And I, you know, we talk about hospitals wanting to do the right thing, but I have 2 of my hospitals that have had to pull back on some of their population health initiatives and going upstream,
right,
because the real crush of revenue is a very real thing. $50 million between 2 hospitals, $50 million in cuts in the prevention health efforts, which meant that our work that we were doing upstream, we had to scramble and get new partners. So how do you find the balance in what you're investing in that really does help to incentivize this within our anchor institutions so that we can move forward? We do have to move beyond research to reality.
Yes, I certainly understand that. I was actually about to say that. but sort of, you know, money and revenue is very important. But as I said, and we've all agreed at the very beginning, we spend an enormous amount on healthcare in this country.
Yeah.
So it's not that we actually lack, in principle, the cumulative resources. We're not spending them, often in both the most effective way within the healthcare system, and certainly between the healthcare system and other systems, other sectors that are critical to that. And this is what we, you know, very much focused on, I think, in all of this conversation. I suggested this might be the panel that solved all the questions, all the problems, and I think we've certainly touched on a lot of them, and not all of them. It's very much an ongoing issue. It's very much, as I said, both question of looking at what's going on in the communities, how we can think about how structures, federal, state, local, can be better aligned, how money can be better aligned, the role of these areas. And it's an ongoing part of our work here. I want to thank the panelists here. I want to thank the previous panelists and Kavita, my kind of co-host as well, and co-mentor. I've learned a lot from you over the years. Thank you again. Please monitor our work here. Please let us know about things that you're doing that are very relevant to this. Please don't hesitate to do that, because this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to learn from everybody in the field. We're trying to learn what policies can help and what get in the way and try to solve some of those. So thank you again. Have a good day, and thank you very much for attending.